unkempt, no longer in Spandau Ballet.
New series of I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue. Monday nights, 6:30 comedy.
Do you mind if I record this for training purposes?
Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
On FM, on BBC Sounds and on your smart speaker, this is BBC Radio 4.
Good morning, it's 6 o'clock on Friday the 5th of June. This is Today with Justin Webb in London and Anna Foster in Salford.
The headlines this morning, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor sublet property at his former home in Windsor, according to a new report on Royal Finances. It also reveals that Princesses Beatrice and Eugenie have their rent paid personally by the King. And the Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, has confirmed that he is going to challenge Keir Starmer and try to become Prime Minister should he win the Makerfield by-election.
Also in today's programme, two competing views this morning on what we should prioritise to keep the world safe. The head of the UK Armed Forces tells us of a new stark reality, the threat from Russia.
This is the most dangerous time I have known in my working life. And the risks and threats to this country are greater than I have known since the Cold War.
While the head of the World Health Organization warns not to disregard other global dangers like Ebola.
Please don't forget the common enemy that we have, a virus that doesn't care about our borders, our politics. We have to be also prepared for that.
And Sir Gareth Southgate speaks ahead of his new documentary on what he sees as a crisis for men and boys.
I think there are a lot of common traits that boys have and historic sort of expectations that weigh on them.
You can hear more of that before 8 o'clock this morning. But first, the BBC News is read for us today by Alan Smith.
The National Audit Office says Andrew Mountbatten Windsor sublet three properties on the estate of his former home, Royal Lodge, in Windsor for an undisclosed sum. The public spending watchdog carried out a major investigation into the residential property arrangements provided to members of the royal family. It found that the former Prince Andrew's daughters were living in palaces with their rent paid personally by the King. Here's our royal correspondent, Sean Coughlan.
The report, the first of its kind for more than 20 years, reveals details of the 12 royal properties used by the former Prince Andrew and his family. They include three cottages belonging to the Crown Estate, which he was allowed to sublet. It's not known for how much, but palace sources said it was only to cover running costs. His daughters, Princesses Beatrice and Eugenie, are shown to pay no rent to live in St James's Palace and Kensington Palace respectively, despite not being working royals. The rent is paid by the King. Buckingham Palace said the report was in line with its commitment to transparency.
Mr. Mountbatten Windsor was photographed driving near his home on the Sandringham estate yesterday with what appeared to be a large bruise on his cheek. It isn't clear what caused the mark, but it's understood to be nothing serious. The Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, has told BBC Question Time that he would seek to join a Labour leadership contest if one is triggered. It's his strongest signal yet that he intends to challenge Sir Keir Starmer if he wins the Makerfield by-election. Five of the candidates vying to represent that seat faced a Question Time audience yesterday evening. Our political correspondent Ian Watson was watching.
Ever since the former MP Josh Simon stood aside to allow Andy Burnham to stand in Makerfield, the Greater Manchester Mayor has been keen to avoid the impression that he's taking its voters for granted. So he tends to use decipherable code about his intentions, such as the need to change Labour. But pressed on Question Time, he said he'd seek to join a leadership contest. Number 10 pointed out that no such contest had been triggered and that Sir Keir Starmer had no intention of walking away from Downing Street. The Reform UK candidate, Robert Kenyon, accused Mr Burnham of using Makerfield as a stepping stone. The Conservative candidate, Michael Winstanley, said he was disgusted and sad that a by-election had been foisted on local people, and the Lib Dems' Jake Austin suggested that Mr Burnham wanted to become Prime Minister by the back door. Mr Kenyon was also challenged on offensive social media posts from his past. He said he'd made mistakes, but had nothing but respect for women. Asked about the murder of Henry Novak, Mr Kenyon said he condemned the violence in Southampton, but claimed there was two-tier policing. The Greens candidate, Sarah Wakefield, argued that black people were still twice as likely to be arrested than their white counterparts, and four times more likely to be stopped by police. Mr. Burnham saw the need for a careful debate on whether to allow people to carry knives for religious reasons.
You can find a full list of all 14 candidates for the Makerfield by-election on the BBC News website. The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, has told the BBC that conflict over identity politics in the UK has the potential to lead to civil war in the long term. Speaking before Vikram Digwa was sentenced to life imprisonment for the murder of Henry Novak, Mrs. Badenoch told a Radio 4 documentary that rising tensions stoked by political groups on the left and right were causing England to become a less harmonious nation.
We are seeing more and more hostility to people of every ethnicity. And it's the political conflict, I think, that is creating this tension. It's really important that politicians understand this rather than use the political conflict as a way to get some votes from one particular community. In the long term, that's how you end up with civil war.
The documentary England's Identity Crisis is available on BBC Sounds. Ukraine's President Zelensky has written to Vladimir Putin, inviting him to a face-to-face meeting with the aim of ending the war between the two countries. He's also shared a copy of it translated into English on his social media platforms. Vitaly Shevchenko reports from Kyiv.
The tone of the letter was defiant, even mocking, drawing attention to Ukraine's recent strikes on Russian territory. President Zelensky even said that after 26 years in power, age is beginning to take its toll on Vladimir Putin. But the letter also provided an invitation to meet face-to-face and discuss ways of ending the war. It's not a new offer from Ukraine's leader. Unlike before, the Kremlin responded saying, Mr. Zelensky is welcome to meet Mr. Putin in Moscow. Hours after the letter was published, the US House of Representatives voted to provide aid to Ukraine and impose new sanctions on Russia, with a number of Republicans joining Democrats to pass the bill in defiance of Donald Trump. But it still needs to be approved by the Senate, and even then it could be vetoed by Mr. Trump.
Donald Trump says he's spoken to both Hezbollah and Israel to try to push forward an American-backed ceasefire in Lebanon. Hezbollah, which is a banned terrorist group in the US, has previously rejected the proposal, which requires it to stop firing rockets into Israel. Scientists at the University of Cambridge say they've performed human trials of a vaccine designed by artificial intelligence in a world first. The AI tool was used to engineer a vaccine which protected against the entire family of coronaviruses. Researchers believe it could help give protection against viruses which haven't yet infected people. Professor Jonathan Heaney from the university says it could help tackle future pandemics.
We've moved from vaccine designed from reacting to the last outbreak to anticipating the next one. And this is about making vaccines that protect us, not just about today's viruses, but protecting us from what could, you know, cause the next outbreak or disease.
That was Professor Jonathan Heaney from the University of Cambridge.
And it brings us to 7 minutes past six and time for our first look at the weather. It comes this morning from Stav Danaeus. Morning, Stav.
Good morning to you, Justin and Anna. Thank you very much. Well, low pressure has been in charge recently, bringing plenty of showers, which have been heavy and thundery in places. And temperatures have been pretty disappointing for this time of year. There's little change to the forecast over the next few days, though today we'll see a bit of a respite as a weak ridge of high pressure crosses the country, bringing lighter winds and fewer showers. So today brings a mixture again of sunny spells and scattered showers, but these showers will be less frequent and not as heavy as the last few days. So actually many places should stay dry with more in the way of sunny spells and variable cloud. Now, Northern Ireland, Wales, southwest of England will become increasingly cloudy later this afternoon with rain and strengthening winds arriving in the far southwest into this evening. Now, winds will be lighter generally across the UK today before they pick up in the south, and temperatures, though, remaining on the cool side, 14 to 18 degrees for the northern half of the UK, 19 to 20 for the southern half. Now, as we head into tonight, this area of low pressure, quite deep for the time of year, will hurtle in. It'll bring wet and windy weather from the southwest, with rain reaching all but Scotland by dawn. And winds will strengthen to become gusty with coastal gales across the southwest. So as we head into tomorrow, it looks mainly cloudy and windy with spells of rain in the morning. Into the afternoon, Scotland will tend to remain mostly cloudy with a few showers, but England, Wales, Northern Ireland will brighten up, see a mixture of sunny spells and scattered showers. Some of these will be heavy and thundery, and it will remain windy in the south with a risk of gales for a time across southwest England. Less windy across the north of the UK, and temperatures tomorrow will range from 15 to 19 degrees.
What a difference a week has made. Thank you, Stav. Let's take a look then at 9 minutes past six at the front pages of the papers this morning. The Daily Telegraph says that Andrew Mountbatten Windsor cashed in with secret rent deals by letting out three cottages on his former Royal Lodge estate in Windsor while he was paying only a peppercorn rent. The Daily Mail leads with another aspect of that report from the National Audit Office, which shows that Andrew's daughters, Beatrice and Eugenie, have lived at palaces rent-free for years. It says they perform no royal duties and have been subsidised for that time by the King and Queen Elizabeth. The Daily Express warns that nothing threatens support for the monarchy more than the spectacle of minor royals enjoying a pampered life. Many of the papers illustrate their coverage this morning with an image of Andrew with a facial bruise, which the Times says is thought to be due to a medical condition. The Sun ties the stories together with the headline, "What a bloody cheek."
The Times says the Greater Manchester Mayor Andy Burnham has fired the starting gun on his attempt to replace Sir Keir Starmer, as he confirmed on Question Time that he would join a Labour leadership race. In an interview with The Guardian, he says Labour should be a broad church with more ministers from the left of the party, and he signalled there would not be a snap election if he became Prime Minister.
The Eye paper says Hampshire Police is pulling in officers from other forces and cancelling some leave after those violent protests over the murder of Henry Novak. The Daily Mirror says Sir Keir Starmer was profoundly humbled to meet the teenager's family, contrasting this with his anger towards the ex-owner Elon Musk for, it says, stoking hatred in the wake of the murder. Writing in The Sun, Julia Hartley Brewer says the Prime Minister's attempts to shut down debate and to police people's words and feelings will only create more division, hatred and tension.
The Times reports that 16,000 people have signed a petition claiming that a Pearson EdXL maths A-level paper was so hard that some students likened it to a war crime. Another described it as like giving birth to triplets. The exam board tells the Times that if a paper is found to be too difficult, grade boundaries can be set to reflect that.
And the Metro this morning considers the ban on football fans taking reusable water bottles into stadiums at the World Cup. The paper calls the decision a last-minute money grab, suggesting that FIFA is sucking fans dry.
11 minutes past six.
It was the unspoken assumption, but now Andy Burnham has confirmed that he would enter any potential Labour leadership contest should he win the Makerfield by-election on the 18th of June. He was asked by the audience for a direct answer during a BBC Question Time special in the constituency last night.
I'm not somebody who gets ahead of myself. I can't do anything unless I'm lucky enough to get the support of people here. But if I get your support, I would seek to represent you at the highest possible level and give this constituency maximum power and influence. I think Wes Streeting seems to have launched a leadership contest, so if that is running, I would seek to join it, but I'd have to persuade members of the Parliament to raise the party to do the same. So that's the only factor.
Also on the panel last night was Reform UK candidate Robert Kenyon, who said the constituency shouldn't be used as a stepping stone to Labour's top job.
I think a big move away from career politicians would certainly help, and having normal people involved in politics. Andy touches on us being the fastest growing economy. Does anybody in Maker feel that we've got the fastest growing economy? Or is it all just kept in Manchester? We keep giving our council tax. There's a bigger percentage every year being taken by Manchester. While Manchester thrives, we're struggling to survive in Wigan. We've been left behind, so My point would be, get normal people in politics, people who care about the place, people who live in the place and people who want to stay here and not use it as a stepping stone for other things.
The Conservative candidate Michael Winstanley pointed out that Andy Burnham is currently midway through a term as the Mayor for Greater Manchester.
It's not that long ago, Andy, that you were telling everybody that this was the greatest job in the world and that you was going to see out your full term. But we're here, halfway through. It's less than 2 years since Josh was elected as my Member of Parliament here in Makerfield. And I'm actually quite disgusted, really, and sad that we're having this by-election foisted upon us. And you said about putting party first. You are putting your party first.
The Liberal Democrat candidate, Jake Austin, said that this was an election for a potential Prime Minister via the back door.
Coming back to what somebody mentioned earlier about honesty being an integral part of politics, now Andy has consistently, we've fought against each other in the 2024 Greater Manchester Mayoral. He's consistently talked a good game about politicians working together to restore trust in politics. But fundamental to that is being honest with residents and constituents. Yet he refuses to say the quiet part out loud, that the reason he asked his mate to step down so he could run in this by-election is not so he could become MP for Makerfield, it's so that he could become the Prime Minister instead.
And the Green Party candidate Sarah Wakefield said that the focus shouldn't be on Westminster, but a serious discussion about policy.
We need to start having serious conversations about who is contributing for a better future for our children, to solve the climate crisis, to get our high streets going, to make sure that we can have the money back in towns and villages so that our young people stay here and work hard and have better lives. So that's what we're all about, is going, let's not just think about Westminster culture that politicians are obsessed with, but think properly about the solutions that we need in this country.
Well, Downing Street, in response to the programme, pointed out that the Labour Party's process for challenging a leader has not yet been triggered, and that the Prime Minister has no intention of walking away from Downing Street just 2 years after winning an election. You will find a full list, should you wish to see it, of all 14 candidates who are standing in the Makerfield by-election. It's on the BBC News website.
6:15 is the time. The Chief of the Defence Staff, Sir Richard Knighton, our most senior military man, has told this programme that Moscow is raising the stakes in its challenges of our air defences. Let us talk to Paul Adams, our diplomatic correspondent, who is on the line. And Paul, he's said these things before about Russia, hasn't he? But the timing is interesting because of the row going on behind the scenes about money.
Yes. I mean, he's choosing his words carefully. He is not going to be, he doesn't want to be seen or heard to be sounding too impatient. But, you know, this is a refrain which he and other defence chiefs and security officials have been talking about for some time now, the threat posed by Russia. We're not at war with Russia, but the warning is that we could be in the future, and that in some ways, in hybrid ways, we are already. He said this is the most dangerous time in his 35-year career. He talks about the number of times Russian jets have launched incursions into British airspace, more in the last 5 months than the whole of last year, with NATO scrambling its jets to deal with these threats. Cyber attacks, the smuggling of technology, you know, sabotage, assassinations, in all sorts of ways, we are under a fairly sustained, call it an attack, by Russia. And I think he and others believe that we are not yet ready to confront those threats, which are growing all the time.
Yeah, and as you say, he doesn't want to get directly involved in the fight about how we get ready and how the money is spent, and indeed whether there is to be an extra amount of money and what that amount is to be. But we are expecting a decision, aren't we? Some announcement from the government pretty soon. And it's interesting, I mean, he did talk, I'm just looking at a transcript of what he said to us, different choices and different priorities. So, I mean, he's talking about potentially us spending our money very differently.
Yes, and a lot of it. You know, the Defence Investment Plan, which has been hugely delayed already, it's supposed to be to stump up or to show how the money will be spent to sustain the Strategic Defence Review that came out, over a year ago now. It is being delayed. The government says it'll be published before the NATO summit next month. There are reports that the Treasury is looking to shave billions of pounds off the plan. There's obviously the impact of the Iran war, which has, you know, adversely affected the amount of cash available for these sorts of things. Donald Trump obviously continues to say that he wants all of America's allies to spend more, 3.5% of GDP. And he's already singled out a number of allies, of course, including the Prime Minister, as somehow failing in their responsibilities. So Sir Keir Starmer faces an acute dilemma, which is the need both from, you know, our most important ally and from his security chiefs to spend more, while other ministers and perhaps the general public are focused on things other than defence.
Paul, thank you. And you can hear the full interview with Sir Richard Knighton at 7:30.
Just coming around to 19 minutes past six now. The business secretary is in Brussels today to try to avert what the steel industry here is calling devastating plans to cut the amount of steel that can enter the EU tariff-free. Will Bain is here with more on that and the rest of the day's business news as well. Hello, Will.
Hello, Anna. Morning, Justin. Yes, both the EU and the UK have been looking at both their quota and tariff systems ahead of planned changes this summer, in large part to protect from Chinese imports of steel. But the potential collateral damage is more tariffs on steel coming in from and going to the EU. Gareth Stace, the chief executive of the trade body UK Steel, told us how important finding a compromise today was.
If something isn't agreed, this would be, and I'm not even understating this, this would be devastating for the steel industry. We export 80% of our exports go to the EU, but half of what we make is exported. And therefore, if that market was really closed off to us, if we couldn't get a deal, then we would certainly see further job losses in the steel industry.
Well, Liam Bates, president of long products at steel producer Marchegaglia Stainless, based in Sheffield, is with us this morning as well. Liam, morning.
Good morning.
Do you agree with that then from Gareth Stace? Is there a real urgency to this?
Yeah, there is definitely an urgency on this, primarily because the proposed tariffs come in place and quotas come in place on July the 1st, which is 4 weeks ago. So definitely an urgency.
Just trying to explain to people, I know it's slightly convoluted, but this is actually mostly to do with how much comes in without any tariffs at all, right? Like the size of the quota that each side would have before any tariffs kicked in.
Correct, yes. So the EU had announced a halving, essentially, of the amount of imports that they would allow to be brought into the EU. And the issue is that they haven't specified that by country. So they're just given a broad brush. Imports will be half of what they were before the tariffs come in.
And that we are doing something similar, right, as well, changing our quotas. And also then once you go beyond that tariff-free quota, ramping up the tariffs to 50% on that imported steel too.
Yeah.
And which has the most impact, I suppose, from your perspective? The ones going out to the EU, or is it parts and products, bits of steel that you guys need or use or refine again coming in the other way, or is it both?
I think it's both, and it's very product dependent. So I think if we take a step back, clearly something is needed to be done. There is global capacity. The EU and US have addressed it through this quota tariff system, and then the UK has to do something. And it would be logical to use the same mechanism. The issue is always that quotas and tariffs are a pretty blunt instrument. They're indiscriminate between a very special product that we might want to import from the EU, and a very standard product that we can produce in the UK. And therefore, there needs to be a lot more detail and negotiation rather than just a blunt instrument of tariff and quota.
Yeah, and this all really to try and stop Chinese steel coming into both markets. So why has it become so, I guess, fractious between the EU and the UK?
As I say, I think one of the primary issues is that the quotas and tariffs are blunt instruments that
they have to cover everybody. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, but what? Therefore, the next step, and this is what I'm hoping is happening in Brussels today, the next step is to refine that blunt instrument. Mm. So to look at what products could be excluded for there to be sort of favoured trader status between the UK and EU, because. Yeah. I think, as Gareth stated, the EU to UK trade has not the problem. It has been healthy over the last, through the 30 years of my industry.
And if it doesn't happen, and as you say, the clock is kind of ticking a little bit too to that July 1st date, what does it mean? Prices going up for sort of input for construction and things like that?
Yeah, I think there's two elements. There's the uncertainty. So we have some of our downstream customers who find that just quoting on orders because they're having to buy in a proportion of UK steel, but also imported steel, and it's just very difficult for them to quote on the orders because they don't know how big the quota is and therefore what tariff they may or may not have to pay. So really call for very much a deal to be made between the EU and the UK, but also for there to be clarity to understand what are the rules of engagement.
Liam, thanks for your time this morning. Liam Bates of the steel producer Marchegaglia Stainless in Sheffield there. Well, Anna McDonald with us this morning as well. Anna, the investment strategy at Hargreaves Lansdowne. Investment strategy director, sorry, Anna, at Hargreaves Lansdowne. Morning.
Good morning, Will.
Shall we start with one that I guess, well, we will see maybe whether there's a share price reaction later on today, but long been known that Reed Hastings, one of the co-founders of Netflix, going to step down as chairman, leaves a pretty transformed company in that three decades.
Yes. I mean, if we look back to receiving our DVDs in the post 29 years ago when Netflix first started, to the transformation that we've really, they've led, I would say, in terms of, you know, now we watch, you know, whole seasons of series that are delivered by Netflix, and they've delivered an amazing content boom and really transformed, I think, how we see entertainment.
Does it fundamentally shift anything, do you think, looking forward then to what the company does next?
I mean, I think that there has been a natural shift now in terms of that Netflix are, they tried to bid for Warner Brothers. They didn't get that. And so I think that maybe became a bit of a point at which, you know, maybe it was a natural time to leave. I mean, remember, 29 years at the top is quite a long time. I wouldn't begrudge him wanting to have take some time off to do something else.
Yeah, sticking with tech and US tech, wobbles on Wall Street yesterday evening, particularly among some of the chip makers.
Yes, I mean, but these have been phenomenal increases that we've seen in all chip makers, actually. And that wobble has continued into Asia overnight, with some of those biggest players, such as SK Hynix and Samsung, down quite sharply. But these are stocks that have done phenomenally well. We've seen the semiconductor index, the Philadelphia Semiconductor Index in the US, has rallied about 172% over the last year. So any kind of, you know, Broadcom has done very well, but it didn't quite beat the highest expectations of investors. So
right, is that what it is now, actually, that the yes. expectations are so high?
The expectations are so high because of the AI build-out. And Broadcom have been, you know, starting to compete in the most advanced semiconductor chips against NVIDIA. But there's been a broad rally across everything, the memory players in Korea that I've mentioned. And so I think that when you have seen such incredible rallies, the investors have such high expectations that even pretty good results that they had weren't quite enough to keep up the excitement.
Well, speaking of high expectations, heard a lot this week about Elon Musk's plans to bring SpaceX shares to market. And now the investment bank leading the sale, Goldman Sachs, says that its $1.78 trillion valuation hinges on revenues at SpaceX's AI division surging by around 100 times by 2030. And the investment research firm Morningstar thinks those expectations are a bit lofty. And Michael Field, its chief equity market strategist, joins us this morning. Michael, morning.
Good morning, Will.
Why so then? Why the worries? Why the concern?
So we think it's a great company. It's hugely fastly growing. It's got some great businesses within that with some great potential. But as you can see, with such levels of growth comes great uncertainty. And now this has come out from Goldman Sachs, one of the huge assumptions that this business, this particular unit, needs to grow by 100-fold over a relatively short time period. So you can see these kind of pressures would lead us to think that this isn't possible ultimately, and that drags back our valuation.
Anna, what's been your take as you've been able to take a bit of a look at a bit more of the numbers as we've gone through the week?
Well, I mean, this is going to be an opportunity to invest in Musk, and many people want to do that. And the biggest part of the business at the moment is Starlink, and then SpaceX, the actual rockets, and a lot of the SpaceX rockets are taking those Starlink satellites into space. And yes, you do need it. It is also about Grok, it's about X, it's about XAI, and there are some pretty significant expectations being put on there. So what we're talking to saying is that, you know, this is an exciting IPO. There's a lot of hype around it. If you do want to take part, you know, we would say, you know, this should just be a very, you know, a small part of your portfolio. Please don't don't hang your whole hat on SpaceX, but you know, we do understand the excitement around it because there aren't very many ways to invest in with Elon Musk and his incredible ambitions.
Michael, is that the bit that makes it different? Makes it different for you guys looking at a company and looking at its numbers, that Elon Musk factor? Because people have said this for years about Tesla's share price as well, and yet it still sort of seems to surge when you're least expecting it, in part because some of those investors are fans, really, almost, in a way.
It's very true. And I think with regard to Tesla, it's been a double-edged sword having Elon Musk as the kind of patriarch of the company for so long. There's been times that it's negatively affected share prices when he's done something off the walls. But more recently, certainly, it's been a case that people have faith in him. They know his influence and they believe that it's a good thing to be associated with him. And that's paid off. We've looked at the growth trajectory of both SpaceX and Tesla over the last number of years, the financial backing that he has and his ability to get deals done, most recently with Anthropic to take some of the capacity utilization of their data centers. It certainly has paid off and you can see why they want to be associated with him.
And is there an element of FOMO here then in the city and on Wall Street as well about this, that people like you guys look at it and have question marks about the business and whether even it hangs together, all the parts of it, and yet it's difficult to bet against that Musk factor?
This is true. And I think ultimately everyone loves an IPO, especially a big IPO. And in, you know, in 10, 20 years time, when you're regaling this story to your children or grandchildren and you're telling them about a company that launches satellites into space was IPOing, I think the first question is going to be asked, why didn't you get involved in that?
Michael, thanks so much for your time this morning. Michael Field, the Chief Equity Market Strategist for Morningstar, and Anna McDonald, Investment Strategy Director at Hargreaves Lansdown.
Well, thank you. 6:30 to the sport. Here's Mike.
Justin, thank you. I think we have to start at Lord's and that roller coaster of a first day of England's first test with New Zealand.
And England are all out for 140. A disappointing display for the home side.
Robertson again, urged on by the crowd. Round the wicket he goes and bowls. He's hit on the pad. Beale for leg before wicket. He's out! 3 wickets in the over. Wow, what a start. New Zealand are 2 for 3.
Robertson bowls to Mitchell. Oh, he's bowled him. He's let it go. And Robertson has got another one. And England are rampant here. 20 for 5.
Yes, Test cricket is back. Despite the rain delays yesterday, we still saw 16 wickets fall at Lord's on a remarkable day's play. It looked grim for England when they were all out for just 140, but they responded with the ball in style. Seamer Ollie Robinson back in the side for the first time in over 2 years, taking 4 wickets, including 3 in the same over, to help reduce New Zealand to 61 for 6.
So speechless about how it's gone. Couldn't really have dreamt up that day. When we lost the toss and got stuck in, we were expecting to hopefully be batting all day. It didn't obviously go our way, but then to come out there with the ball as a whole group, we were right on it from ball one, and yeah, just amazing. It's just such a special day. I have no words, to be honest.
What does day two have in store? We'll find out. Play gets underway at 11 a.m. We will speak to the former England captain Andrew Strauss later in the programme. Next to Italy, and a successful night for the British athletes at the Rome Diamond League. Firstly, Georgia Hunter-Bell, who won the 1500 metres.
Really happy to come away with the win. The first race of the season is very tough because you don't know where you are. So it's like once you get going a little bit, then you can judge what you do. But yeah, I'm very happy.
Meanwhile, after sealing the pole vault title in Rome, Britain's Molly Coldrey says her aim for this season is to improve on her own British record.
Absolutely, it's definitely going to come this season, I hope. I was just kind of looking after myself today. It's a long season. My back was a little bit sore and it was just the right decision for me today. But I think when I go back to full approach, I'm definitely aiming for that.
Finally, football, and Liverpool have their man. The club announced last night that the former Bournemouth boss, Andone Iraola, is their new manager. The Spaniard has signed a 2-year deal. We'll have more on this in the next hour of the programme. Meanwhile, qualifying for next summer's Women's World Cup resumes later this evening, and a big night awaits for England against the world champion Spain in Mallorca. Here's Vicky Sparks.
England have the chance to make a real statement here. Avoid defeat to the reigning world champions and they will qualify for next year's tournament in Brazil with a game to spare. They've managed to best Spain in both of their most recent encounters, an impressive 1-0 win at Wembley in April and of course via a penalty shootout in the European Championship final last summer. 3-time Ballon d'Or winner Aitana Bonmatí is back in the Spain squad, whilst Lauren James and Lucy Bronze have shaken off knocks for England. It's a rivalry, says Bronze, bonds that she adores as these two meet once more with so much on the line.
You can listen to that match on BBC Sounds, elsewhere Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, also all involved in Women's World Cup qualifiers this evening.
Mike, thank you.
BBC Radio 3 Unwind. Music to unwind your mind. Find your morning focus.
Welcome. We have some wonderful sounds to experience together.
Bring calm to your afternoon.
This is the Mindful Mix.
And drift off to a peaceful sleep at night.
Every time I hear this track, I just start breathing slower.
Just ask your smart speaker to play Radio 3 Unwind.
Well, we can do that, I suppose. Or you can continue listening to Today. Because it is 25 to 7, you are listening to Today on Radio 4. Anna in Salford, me in London, with Alan Smith reading the news.
The National Audit Office says Andrew Manbatten Windsor sublet three properties on the estate of his former home Royal Lodge in Windsor for an undisclosed sum. An investigation by the public spending watchdog into the property arrangements of members of the royal family also found that the former Prince Andrew's daughters were living in palaces with their rent paid personally by the king. The Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, said he would try to enter any Labour leadership contest should he win the Makerfield by-election later this month. His comments, made on BBC Question Time, are the strongest indication yet that he intends to challenge Sir Keir Starmer. The Reform candidate, Robert Kenyon, accused Mr Burnham of using the constituency as a stepping stone. Downing Street said no leadership contest had been triggered and the Prime Minister wouldn't walk away. A full list of candidates standing in the Makerfield by-election can be found on the BBC News website. The Conservative leader Kemi Badenoch has told the BBC that she believes conflict over identity politics could, in the long term, potentially lead to civil war in the UK. Speaking before Vikram Digwa was sentenced to life imprisonment for the murder of Henry Novak, Mrs. Badenoch said England was becoming less harmonious because of rising tensions stoked by political groups on the left and right. Ukraine's President Zelensky has written an open letter to Vladimir Putin, inviting him to take part in face-to-face talks to end the war. In it, Mr. Zelensky says Russians have grown tired of Ukrainian drone attacks, inflation and fuel shortages. And the head of the artificial intelligence firm Anthropic has warned that the technology is nearing a point where it could develop without human input. Jack Clark is calling for the ability to slow the progression of AI, saying the company's own data had shown AI dramatically speeding up its self-improvement, narrowing the human role at each step.
Thank you, Alan. It's 24 minutes to 7 now. There was a special question time last night from Makerfield, just under a fortnight away from what could be a hugely consequential by-election. Harry Farley is our political correspondent. Morning, Harry. What did we learn from it?
Well, we learned for the first time that Andy Burnham explicitly said that he would be challenging the Prime Minister. I mean, until now, his well-known ambitions for number 10 have been implicit. And I think his team have been hesitant, really, and wary, particularly in light of how this by-election came to be, a Labour MP specifically standing down in order to try and get Andy Burnham back to Parliament. His team are conscious of not being seen to take the voters of Makerfield for granted. They're also wary of the attack that we heard from Reform's Robert Kenyon and other candidates, that those towns of Ashton, Wigan, Ince in Makerfield are a stepping stone for a career politician. But last night, he did make his ambitions clear, made for the first time that he would challenge the Prime Minister. And it's a reminder, really, of that slightly bizarre nature of this campaign, that at least implicitly, both Reform UK and Labour, Labour's candidates, are saying, vote for me to replace Keir Starmer. And so much so that Number 10 felt the need to issue a statement in response saying the Prime Minister will not walk away. I suppose more broadly, you've got a sense of the weight of this by-election by how national issues like the murder of Henry Novak dominated. It was the first time that Andy Burnham had given his response praising Greater Manchester Police for removing rainbow flags on cars, not taking the knee, for example, suggesting that he would be open to reviewing the religious exemptions to carrying ceremonial knives after that murder. Robert Kenyon, for Reform, for his part, faced questions about his past online comments and was accused of sexism. He said he had nothing but respect for women. And of course, you've got a full list of the other candidates available on the BBC News website.
And tell us a little more, Harry, about these comments by Kemi Badenoch about conflict over identity politics potentially leading to civil war in the UK. Now, that was an interview recorded for a new BBC documentary before, it's worth saying, the events of this week. But tell us a bit more about what she said.
Yes, she said that we're seeing more and more hostility to people of every ethnicity. And she says that's because political conflict is being brought into an area where we didn't have political conflict. And she says that is creating tension, and goes on to say that it's important that politicians understand this and don't use political conflict as a way to get votes from one particular community. Now, as you say, that was an interview recorded a few weeks ago. It's not in response to the events of this week or the murder of Henry Novak. And she was talking about a potential challenge in the future. But it does, those remarks do reflect, I think, the tone and response that we've seen from her this week in response to the murder of Henry Novak. There has been a shift in the debate, at least in Parliament, where it's moved away from being, I suppose, the traditional left versus right on this question to really being Reform UK, Nigel Farage, to a lesser extent, Restore Britain as well, versus everyone else. And that's the new nature of that, the political response, at least, to the events of this week.
Thank you, Harry. Harry Farley there, our political correspondent. We will reflect on that as well in a little more detail with the Deputy Prime Minister, the Justice Secretary, David Lammy, at 8:10.
Time now 6:40. Former Prince Andrew back on the front pages this morning because of a report out from the National Audit Office. Let us talk to Sean Coughlin, our royal correspondent. And this report tells us what, Sean?
Well, it's a report that's followed the scandal surrounding Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor. And we've got some more details of his property arrangements. As the headlines have shown this morning, that he was subletting three cottages that belonged to the Crown Estate near to Royal Lodge. We don't know for how much for, but that only stopped in April 2026. Also, we found out that his daughters, Beatrice and Eugenie, are not paying any rent themselves on properties in St. James's Palace and Kensington Palace. The rent's paid by the Privy Purse, which is the King's personal money, and that goes into the royal household. But I think the optics aren't at all good on that. And I think, once again, that sort of, when they're not working royals and when I think young people trying to get property is such a sensitive issue, it raises all sorts of questions about entitlement again. And I think this is one of those sort of moments when perhaps the palace is once again picking up pieces from the former Prince Andrew.
And of course, the National Audit Office report is the beginning of a process that will also go to the Public Accounts Committee of the House of Commons, who are going to investigate royal finances on the back of this.
Well, that's right. I mean, this is just the sort of the starting whistle. It doesn't actually draw any conclusions. It's very careful to say this is a factual inquiry. We're setting out the facts. They're not saying whether it's right or wrong. They're not saying whether this is value for money. That will be for MPs to come out later. And I think that process will begin once we've had the announcements around the royal finances, which usually come later this month. So there's plenty more for this to come and plenty more to pick out and for people to express their concerns.
And Sean, I mentioned he's on the front pages. He's on the front pages pictured in a car with a bruise apparently on the side of his face. Do we know anything more about that?
Well, as you said, it's a rather haunting image, really, isn't it? And we don't know what caused it, other than we've been advised that it's not a matter for concern and it's nothing considered to be serious. But I suppose that's a matter of perspective. But it is, and it's another image, another example of really somebody's downfall. And we're talking now about his time in Royal Lodge when he had 12 properties for him, his staff, and his family. And now he's staying in Sandringham in very different circumstances.
Mm. Sean Coughlin, thank you very much. And we will return to this at 7:10.
It's 7:18 now.
And the Ebola outbreak in Africa is unlikely to spread worldwide, according to the head of the WHO. It's a big regional problem, he says, but it is not going to be a global one. He also made an impassioned plea in an interview with this programme for more global spending on disease prevention and control and less spending on arms. Let us talk to Barbara Platasha, our Africa correspondent, who's on the line. And I mean, he's just back, isn't he, from a visit to the affected area, and he is worried about what's going on there. But interestingly, also quite optimistic, actually, that there can be the necessary measures put in place to get people confident enough in the local authorities for the spread to stop.
Yes, he had mixed messages when he returned. His top line essentially was that the Ebola outbreak had a big head start. So the response is still behind. They're behind the curve and still catching up. And he mentioned the reasons for that. This is an area of conflict, of mass displacement, which creates conditions for the easy spread of the virus. The population is vulnerable because of humanitarian situation. It's a rare species of Ebola that at first wasn't detected with available testing, and the testing capacity was very limited anyway. Now, the response has ramped up with more testing, with more medicines, and so on. And crucially, as Dr. Tedros has mentioned, and others as well, there are efforts to try to engage with the community because there's a lot of mistrust, misinformation, suspicion of outside authorities, and that has been affecting the response. And it's not only opposition, but it's also just you need the cooperation of the local community if you're going to trace the contacts of victims and so on. So that's a really core part of the response. What he has said also, and even while he was there, is that there have been people recovering, even though there's no vaccine. So if you get early health care, it means that you have better chance. And he said that that was a positive sign.
And his wider point that he makes to us, I mean, in a sense, it's not exactly a headline, is it? But the head of WHO says we should spend more globally on health. Well, that's not a great surprise. But he's incredibly impassioned about it, isn't he? And he takes directly head on the idea that we are all spending more as nations on defence or planning to, and suggesting pretty strongly that actually that's the wrong way to go.
Yes, yes, he is quite impassioned about that. I mean, because what you've seen with this Ebola crisis is something that has probably been in the works, like the conditions created for it to an extent have been taking place over the past year or two. The cuts in international aid have had a big impact in the DR Congo, Democratic Republic of Congo, in weakening the response, especially from the U.S., but more than that. Now, he does say that both the U.S. and U.K. are contributing to the Ebola response, but he stresses that it's a wider problem of priority, that more and more countries are cutting aid to boost defense, and he has warned them that they shouldn't forget about the invisible and common enemy, infectious disease, something like COVID, which killed millions around the world. And this requires not just a response to an outbreak, but it requires constant funding to create the systems and networks in place to detect early, to cooperate on and getting treatments and getting care to the people involved. So, yes, he's very worried about that particular aspect of it.
Barbara Platasha, thank you. You can hear the full interview with the head of the WHO, Dr. Tedros, at 8:30.
It's 14 minutes to 7 now. Russia's ambassador to the UK was summoned to the Foreign Office this week following the latest attacks on Ukraine and after one of its drones hit a block of flats in Romania. Well, yesterday in Parliament, MPs demanded that the government keep up the pressure on Russia's leadership. Here's Alicia McCarthy.
Earlier this week, one of Russia's largest air attacks in its war against Ukraine left 22 people dead, including two children. Behind the statistics, there were human stories. A Labour MP, John Slinger, read out a message he'd received from one Ukrainian just that morning.
Even this week, there are new deaths, new wounded children, new families destroyed. My Instagram and Facebook feeds are full of these stories. Children injured on the way to shelters. Mothers and grandmothers killed. Little ones left bleeding while people wait for the attack to end before help can reach them. This is what Russia's attacks on civilian infrastructure mean for Ukrainians. Not numbers, but children's lives being stolen.
A Foreign Office Minister, Seema Malhotra, described Russia's latest aggressions as reckless.
Russia is now launching an average, Mr. Speaker, of over 5,000 drones a month at Ukraine, more than five times the 2024 average. And last month alone, Russia fired over 7,100 drones, a new record, with the highest civilian casualty count since April 2022.
The minister said the government condemned this escalation, and that was why the Russian ambassador had been summoned. Seema Malhotra was in the Commons to answer a question from the Conservative, Sir John Whittingdale.
Ukraine has developed some of the best technology in the world against the use of drones, but Russia is stepping up the use of ballistic missiles and cruise missiles. Can she say what the government will do to try and boost Ukraine's air defences, particularly with the supply of Patriot anti-missile defences?
The minister told him the UK would supply at least 120,000 drones to Ukraine this year.
The SNP's Kirsty Blackman noted that
targeting civilian infrastructure is a war crime. Can the minister lay out what the UK are doing with allies to protect and preserve the evidence of those war crimes in order that prosecutions can be brought in the future?
Seema Malhotra didn't answer that directly, telling her only that there was work going on. A Labour MP, Clive Efford, reflected that
those of us who are children of people who went through the Second World War are the closest we have now to remembering that we cannot appease dictators in Europe and we know what it leads to. And with that in mind, after such a long period of war, isn't this a time to press home on sanctions and restrictions on Russia?
Last month, a minister apologised for what he said had been the clumsy handling of the announcement of a new package of measures against Russia after it was widely reported that sanctions against the country were being watered down. Seema Malhotra insisted the government was in fact toughening restrictions, but some on jet fuel and certain oil products were being phased in.
We will continue to keep the pressure on Russia and we will continue to work with our allies internationally to make sure that we are strengthening that pressure and supporting Ukraine.
The Conservative Shadow Foreign Secretary Dame Priti Patel described President Putin's actions as evil. She insisted her party would back the government on Ukraine when it got things right.
But the recent shameful actions to loosen sanctions on Russian oil and gas are not acceptable to us. So will the government take action in light of the continued threat from Putin? And would they not rather drill in the North Sea rather than loosening the sanctions on Russian oil and gas?
The minister repeated her insistence that sanctions had been strengthened, not weakened. But a Liberal Democrat, Claire Young, also pressed her over Russia's fossil fuel exports. She said campaigners had criticised
what they see as a lack of enforcement of the rules. What will the government do to ensure sanctions are not just a paper tiger?
Seema Malhotra said Russia's Deputy Prime Minister had spoken about the impact of the restrictions.
The UK's Russia sanctions regime is absolutely designed to maximise impact on Putin's regime, to cripple supply chains and technological advancement and undermine Russia's war effort.
A Conservative, Sabina Jenkin, feared Russia would continue to escalate its air attacks as it started to lose the war.
What is the government doing to ensure that we are properly prepared to face down this escalation? It's all very well ministers coming to this House and wringing their hands and condemning these atrocities, but what are we going to do to deter this atrocity?
The minister said the UK would continue to work with its allies, and she agreed that Russia's failure on the battlefield was likely to be one reason why it was increasing its air raids on Ukraine.
That was Alicia McCarthy reporting on Yesterday in Parliament. It brings us to 9 minutes to seven. And talking of the threat from Russia, the government is coming under huge pressure to raise defence spending, as we all know. Indeed, they are committed to doing it. We're going to hear at 7:30 the chief of the defence staff making the case that we are facing dangers from Russia unprecedented in recent times and we have to act accordingly. But one of the things that seems to be holding Sir Keir Starmer back from actually spending the full amount of extra money is a feeling on the Labour backbenches that he is perhaps being bounced into it. Let us talk to Kim Johnson, who is the MP for Liverpool Riverside and is on the line now. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Justin. Good to speak to you this morning.
Thank you for coming on. What do you make of the decision that we understand is going to be announced pretty quickly, possibly in the next week or so, the decision that needs to be made now about extra spending on defence?
But then we've heard an awful lot recently, haven't we, Justin? We've just been talking about the war in Ukraine that's been raging for 4 years, you know, to the cost of the UK taxpayer of £21.8 billion, while people in this country, particularly in Liverpool Riverside, are struggling with the cost of living. And we know that wars do have a massive impact on our inflation. We've seen the cost of food and fuel go up. And I think what we should be doing is really looking at the basics at this moment in time and looking at how we support the most vulnerable in our society. And by using that money in terms of helping and supporting, I have said many times that welfare, not warfare, is what we need to be focused on at this moment in time.
Are you saying that money that goes at the moment to Ukraine, that we spend in Ukraine, shouldn't?
Well, I think the money has gone. It's gone to support Ukraine. But all I'm saying is that we are struggling in this country at the moment, and we need to be focusing on the basics and things of getting things right for our most vulnerable right. members of society.
I suppose there are two arguments there, aren't there? And approach each of them, if you would. Number one, that there is a sort of moral duty to help Ukraine because they've been attacked by Russia, and we ought to help. But number two, that actually it's good for us to assist Ukraine and indeed to spend more on defence because they'll come for us next.
Well, it's a moral duty to support Ukraine, but we look at what's happening at the moment in the Middle East and Gaza. You know, everybody seems to be turning a blind eye to what's happening in Gaza and the genocide that's been perpetrated by the Israeli government. You know, so we are, and we should be supporting people across the globe at the moment. We are seeing humanitarian crisis all across the globe. Look at Sudan, look at Yemen and Gaza. So we do have moral duties to support those people, but sadly that's not happening equally across the world.
And what about the threat from Russia to us?
Yes, we are under threat all the time, but in terms of increasing our military just means that we are likely to get involved in more interventions and more conflicts that has a massive impact on us as a country and our people.
OK, well, we're going to hear, as I was saying, from the Chief of the Defence Staff at 7.30. But Kim Johnson, MP for Liverpool Riverside, thank you very much.
At 6 minutes to seven, the government's weighing up a law change to give unmarried couples more protection on things like inheritance. At the moment, you need to be legally married to receive certain rights. But a consultation's being launched to gauge opinion on whether that is the right approach. It can be a divisive topic, this one. Some people say that you shouldn't have to marry just to improve your legal rights. But for others, changing the law weakens that institution. Well, Ed Davies is Research Director at the Centre of Social Justice. Good morning.
Morning. Thanks for having me.
Tell me a bit more about your research. You think that this is something that would weaken marriage?
Yeah, so our work at the Centre for Social Justice is about how can we give people the best shot in life, particularly vulnerable people, people on low incomes, that sort of thing. And consistently, we find that in the context of family, being married is the best place to be, that marriage versus cohabitation or any other form of family structure does best. And our concern would be with changes like this, that you would undermine that. Marriage is already in a really bad place in the UK, and this would sort of preserve that in aspic when we should be saying, right, okay, what is best for people and how can we encourage it? And this would do the opposite, I think.
And what about that counter argument where people say, look, I want those rights and protections, but they might choose not to get married? It might be something that they don't want to do, where they would have to just to get those benefits.
Yeah, I understand that. And as a sort of a legal construct, marriage is there for that reason, that if you want these rights and benefits, we ask that you take on this obligation. And that there are people as well that choose not to get married on purpose because they don't want those obligations. But I think we're sort of viewing it the wrong way as legal rights. The reason that we look at marriage and that we would encourage marriage is that it is a great benefit. The people who are married, they live longer, they are wealthier, they are happier, they are less lonely. And so as governments, we should be looking to encourage this, not just give rights and so on that would undermine it.
How do we legislate then? And I don't necessarily mean legislate in the pure sense, but for people, for example, who might be cohabiting, one of them might die suddenly, they realise that they're about to lose their house or rights to a pension. What about situations like that?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that the government's job is to encourage people who are in committed relationships with responsibility, with financial ties, to get married.
Is that the job of a government to push people towards marriage if that's not what they want?
It's certainly the job of a government to create the society that it wants. And if people don't want to get married, they absolutely shouldn't get married. That's already a possibility. And getting married itself is also a possibility. But what we want as government, as lawmakers, is to make laws that encourage the flourishing of all society. And the marriage is this great benefit. And it can encourage it. It does. And it discourages it too at the moment through the benefit system and through the tax system. We have rules and regulations that make marriage harder, that make it less beneficial. And there's plenty that the government could do to say, this is a good thing. We're going to remove all the barriers in the way of it. And we're going to encourage it because we as a society will do better by encouraging it.
Ed Davies, Research Director at the Centre for Social Justice. Thanks for being with us.
Couple of minutes to seven. Let us look ahead to this afternoon.
Two pizzas, 1 mile, 8 minutes.
7.90, except that was my first mistake.
Drama on BBC Radio 4.
Hello, your door is open.
When a delivery rider makes a shocking discovery.
Miss, can you hear me?
Oh no.
Can he escape what he saw?
Officers have confirmed the death has been formally ruled a suicide.
A new five-part thriller.
You don't think she did it? I don't either. Find them.
The Courier begins this afternoon at 2:15. To listen on your smart speaker, say play Radio 4.
Let's check the weather with Stav Danaos.
Thanks very much, Anna and Justin. Good morning to you. Low pressure has been in charge recently, as we already know, bringing lots of showers, which have been heavy and thundery in places, and temperatures have been sitting below par for the time of year. There is little change to the forecast over the next few days, but today we'll see a brief respite as a weak ridge of high pressure moves across the country, bringing lighter winds and fewer showers ahead of a deep area of low pressure, which will arrive tonight. Now, today brings a mixture of sunny spells and again a few scattered showers, mainly in northern and western areas, but these showers will be less frequent and nowhere near as heavy as what we've seen over the last few days. So actually many places will stay dry with more in the way of sunshine with variable cloud. Winds, like I mentioned, lighter than yesterday. Temperatures still remain on the cool side for the time of year, 14 to 18 for the northern half of the UK, 19 to 20 across the south. Then into tonight, any showers fade away, but cloud, wind and rain spreads in from the southwest, turning heavy at times with gale force winds in the southwest by dawn. So into the start of the weekend tomorrow will be mostly cloudy, wet and windy in the morning. It will clear to sunshine and showers into the afternoon. Temperatures 15 to 19 degrees.
Staff, thank you for that. You're listening to Today on Radio 4. It's 7 o'clock on Friday the 5th of June. The headlines this morning. An official report has revealed that Andrew Mountbatten Windsor was subletting cottages on his former estate at Royal Lodge and that Princes Beatrice and Eugenie have their rent paid by the King. The Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, has said during a BBC Question Time debate that he'll challenge Sir Keir Starmer if there is a Labour leadership contest. And the Chief of the Defence Staff, Sir Richard Knighton, has told this programme Russia risks crossing a line by sending military aircraft into UK airspace.
This is the most dangerous time I have known in my working life. And the risks and threats to this country are greater than I have known since the Cold War.
Also coming up in this hour of the programme, as more women give birth by emergency C-section, we investigate the impact on the NHS. And Sir Gareth Southgate speaks to us ahead of his new documentary on what he sees as a crisis among young men.
If we're to have a better country moving forward, we've got to get the maximum out of our young people. And it feels as though that might require a slightly different approach.
The BBC News is read this morning by Alan Smith.
The National Audit Office says Andrew Mountbatten Windsor sublet three properties on the estate of his former home Royal Lodge in Windsor for an undisclosed sum. The public spending watchdog carried out a major investigation into the residential property arrangements provided to members of the royal family. It found that the former Prince Andrew's daughters were living in palaces with their rent paid personally by the King. Here's our royal correspondent Sean Coughlan.
The report, the first of its kind for more than 20 years, was prompted by the scandals surrounding Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, and it reveals details of the 12 royal properties used by the former prince and his family. They include three cottages belonging to the Crown Estate, which he was allowed to sublet. It's not known for how much, but palace sources say it was only to cover running costs. His daughters, Princesses Beatrice and Eugenie, are shown to pay no rent to live in St James's Palace and Kensington Palace respectively, despite not being working royals. The rent is paid by the King from personal money. Norman Baker, a former Home Office minister and critic of royal finances, says the public are being taken for a ride. But Buckingham Palace said the report was in line with a royal household's commitment to transparency.
Mr. Mountbatten Windsor was photographed driving near his home on the Sandringham estate yesterday with what appeared to be a large bruise on his cheek. It isn't clear what caused the mark, but it's understood to be nothing serious. The Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, has told BBC Question Time he would seek to join a Labour leadership contest if one is triggered. It's his strongest signal yet that he intends to challenge Sir Keir Starmer if he wins the Makerfield by-election. Five of the candidates vying to represent that seat faced a Question Time audience yesterday evening. Our political correspondent Ian Watson was watching.
Ever since the former MP Josh Simon stood aside to allow Andy Burnham to stand in Makerfield, the Greater Manchester Mayor has been keen to avoid the impression that he's taking its voters for granted. So he tends to use decipherable code about his intentions, such as the need to change Labour. But pressed on Question Time, he said he'd seek to join a leadership contest. Number 10 pointed out that no such contest had been triggered and that Sir Keir Starmer had no intention of walking away from Downing Street. The Reform UK candidate, Robert Kenyon, accused Mr Burnham of using Makerfield as a stepping stone. The Conservative candidate, Michael Winstanley, said he was disgusted and sad that a by-election had been foisted on local people, and the Lib Dems' Jake Austin suggested that Mr Burnham wanted to become Prime Minister by the back door. Mr Kenyon was also challenged on offensive social media posts from his past. He said he'd made mistakes, but had nothing but respect for women. Asked about the murder of Henry Novak, Mr Kenyon said he condemned the violence in Southampton, but claimed there was two-tier policing. The Greens candidate, Sarah Wakefield, argued that black people were still twice as likely to be arrested than their white counterparts and four times more likely to be stopped by police. Mr Burnham saw the need for a careful debate on whether to allow people to carry knives for religious reasons.
You can find a full list of all 14 candidates for the Makerfield by-election on the BBC News website. The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, has told the BBC that conflict over identity politics in the UK could lead to civil war in the long term. In an interview for a BBC Radio 4 documentary on Englishness, recorded before Vikram Digwa was sentenced to life imprisonment for the murder of Henry Novak, Mrs. Badenoch warned of rising tensions as groups on the left and the right direct more and more hostility towards people of every ethnicity. Here's Newsnight's political editor Nick Watt.
Kemi Badenoch has earned a reputation for speaking her mind on social and cultural issues. But now she has spelt out what she sees as the danger as England becomes, in her view, a less harmonious nation. It's the potential of civil war. According to Mrs. Badenoch, this isn't on the cards anytime soon. The Conservative leader was speaking to a Radio 4 documentary, England's Identity Crisis.
We are seeing more and more hostility to people of every ethnicity. And it's the political conflict, I think, that is creating this tension. It's really important that politicians understand this rather than use the political conflict as a way to get some votes from one particular community. But in the long term, that's how you end up with civil war.
In her interview, Mrs. Badenoch didn't name any parties as carrying out this practice. But in previous comments in the wake of the Gorton and Denton by-election in February, she said it was appalling that separatist campaigning was carried out in Urdu by the Green Party. The Greens have been approached for comment. The debate about English national identity has taken on a harder edge over the past year after some figures on the right said that Englishness is related to ancestry.
You can listen to the documentary England's Identity Crisis at 1:30 on Sunday afternoon here on Radio 4 or now on BBC Sounds. The Chief of the Defence Staff, Air Chief Marshal Sir Richard Knighton, has told this programme that Russia risks crossing a line with its incursions into UK airspace. He said he was confident the government was increasing defence spending in line with the threat. Our diplomatic correspondent Paul Adams reports.
Sir Richard said Russia was challenging the UK's defences in a number of ways. He cited incursions into UK airspace by Russian strategic aircraft, as many in the past 5 months as in the whole of last year. Moscow, he said, was raising the stakes. Addressing recent criticism of the UK's diminished defence capabilities, Sir Richard said he was confident the government was aware of the threats this country faced and was increasing spending accordingly. In recent decades, the military had concentrated on preparing for short, limited conflicts. Now, he said, the UK needed to be ready for much longer wars, such as the one in Ukraine.
Ukraine's President Zelensky has written a letter to Russia's President Putin proposing a ceasefire and a meeting. In the document, Mr. Zelensky strikes a defiant tone, drawing attention to his country's recent strikes on Russian territory. The Kremlin has responded, saying Mr. Zelensky is welcome to meet Mr. Putin in Moscow. There's a warning from a group of MPs that the asylum system is failing to cope in the face of severe pressure. The Public Accounts Committee said its conclusions were disturbing and said the government was at considerable risk of repeating past failures. The Home Office said the system was being reformed and hotel and support costs were coming down. Here's our political correspondent Damian Grammaticus.
Control of the asylum system had been all but lost, the chair of the committee, Sir Geoffrey Clifton Brown, said, adding there was a focus on short-term fixes, and it was no wonder a directionless bureaucracy resulted in asylum seekers either left in limbo or lost. The MP's report described as shocking and unacceptable the fact the Home Office couldn't keep track of all those whose claims had failed and so didn't know with certainty who was still in the country. The Home Office said change was underway. Asylum claims were down, hotel use was falling, and immigration enforcement activity was at the highest level on record.
Sir Gareth Southgate says the way boys and girls are taught in schools should be changed to take account of their fundamental differences. The former England football manager told this programme that reform was needed to tackle the crisis facing boys and young men who feel isolated and are struggling with education, employment, identity and mental health.
If we're to have a better country moving forward, we've got to get the maximum out of our young people. And it feels as though that might require a slightly different approach when we're educating and developing young men compared to educating and developing young women. And I think anybody that's worked with either sex at a younger age knows there are some fundamental differences.
You can hear the full interview at 7:50, and Sir Gareth's documentary is on BBC One on Monday at 9 p.m.
Thank you for that. 9 minutes past seven is the time. What are we to make of the news that Andrew Mountbatten Windsor charged his staff to live in his Windsor estate, in spite of the fact that he only paid a peppercorn rent himself? The revelation comes from the National Audit Office, which has conducted a review of royal finances. The Crown Estate said it welcomed the NAO review. It confirmed that its leases with members of the royal family were agreed in line with independent professional advice, it said. Open market valuations as well. And a spokesman for Buckingham Palace said the report was in line with the royal household's commitment to transparency. Let us talk to Lady Hodge, Margaret Hodge, Labour peer, former chair herself of the Public Accounts Committee of the Commons. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
On the subletting arrangement, first of all, do you think that was or was not acceptable?
I think you've got to ask questions about it. Let me just say one thing. I'm really pleased the report has been published. It's the beginnings. We're beginning to get a little bit of insight into the royal finances. I'm very concerned that I don't think it covers all of the Crown Estate properties, and I'll come back to that. And I'm very concerned that, for example, in the issue that you raised, the National Audit Office was not able to find how much money was being secured by Andrew Mountbatten Windsor from letting the properties.
Yeah, because it's interesting, isn't it? We don't know whether he actually personally made a profit, do we? Or possibly that he didn't make any profit at all, which presumably, in your view, would be an acceptable arrangement then?
I think he did make money out of it. Let me just go back. The purpose of the Crown Estate, its first duty, is to generate financial returns and value for the people of the UK, for us as the taxpayer. And if the Crown Estate is operating in a way that is not just serving the taxpayer, but also serving the royal family, it's not meeting its basic purpose, and that causes me worry. And I think it should cause worry to the royal family as well. We all want a royal family to continue to be respected, valued, and treasured. I want a royal family, but in a modern era, that does require proper transparency and accountability. This is the first I've heard that money was earned from properties that the royal family were in some way in control of, that went into their pockets. The report talks about 3.6 million. We don't know if that's all. And it's shocking that the National Audit Office was not able to establish how much money Andrew Mountbatten Windsor secured from the property.
But we don't know, do we? We don't know that it did go into his pocket. It may well have been just spent on upkeep on the estate. That's the point, isn't it? We don't know.
Well, we don't know. We don't know that is true, although the Crown Estate itself spent money on the upkeep of the estate, and we do know a bit of that. And the other thing that is worrying is that people like Beatrice and Eugenia and the Kents, Prince Michael Kent and his wife, were also being subsidised in the way that they were living on the estate. They weren't paying rent, and yet they're not working royals. Now, is it appropriate for non-working royals to be subsidised by the taxpayer from a fund that belongs to the taxpayer?
But if
and
you look at
to maximise income, to
if
the
you
taxpayer.
Look at their situation, the princesses Beatrice and Eugenie, they have access to the royal palaces. We know this from the report, and they have access to apartments in the royal palaces. But the money is paid by the king; it's his own money, which is, I mean, I think people will say, well, he can do that if he wants to, can't he?
Well. Yeah, this is something we talked about last time we had a discussion about this. The royal family get money from a number of sources. They get their personal money, and of course, if he's using his personal money, that's fine. They also secure money from the sovereign grant, 132 million, and they have money from from the Duchy of Cornwall and the Duchy of Lancaster. And I think one of the most interesting lines in the report is that the report says the prince does not own the Duchy of Cornwall. I think that's really important. I've been arguing that for a long time, and the royal family have been saying, right. No, it is their private money.
Just a final thought.
If this is public money, it's really important that there should be transparency, accountability, understanding of what tax they pay where and when, and then I think you can get that confidence back in the integrity of the royal finances and into the royal family.
Final thought. Public Accounts Committee now use this report, don't they, and mount their own report, and they're about to start doing that. Should they hear directly, do you think, the Public Accounts Committee from members of the royal family?
I mean, I don't feel particularly strongly about that. I do think that they should hear from those that work for them. I think, you know, who manage the money for them. Although I have to say that when I looked at the Duchy of Cornwall, the now king chaired the board meetings of that particular duchy. And we learned today that that was not his money. So I think you do it on role, really, rather than on personality.
Right.
So if either of them do chair any of these things, they ought to. But do remember, this is the most important thing. The Crown Estates is our money. It's taxpayers' money. It's not theirs. And and whoever runs that has to always ensure that the taxpayers' interest is felt on.
Yeah. I mean, the point the palace often make, isn't it, is that it's public money, not necessarily money coming directly from the taxpayer. But you've made your point as well this morning, Baroness Hodge, Margaret Hodge. Thank you.
It's 7:15. What did we learn from last night's Question Time in Makerfield, 2 weeks away from the by-election there? Five of the candidates were on the panel. You can find a full list of all of them on the BBC News website. Our political editor, Chris Mason, was watching. Morning, Chris. Hello, Chris. Can you hear me?
Morning. Morning.
Ah, there you are. Hello, hello. It is a little bizarre, isn't it, that Andy Burnham's official confirmation that he is prepared to challenge Sir Keir Starmer for the Labour leadership only came last night, given the chain of events that brought him there.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You know, Fiona Bruce wasn't there at random. I haven't done two trips to those communities to the south of Wigan for any other reason than what we know to be Andy Burnham's ambitions. And there is still a delicate dance going on here. We got a hop, a shimmy further than he stepped before in what he said last night. But even then, it was careful. So he said, I think Wes Streeting seems to have launched a leadership contest. And we should say formally, of course, he hasn't. And then he says, Mr. Burnham, so if that is running, I would seek to join it. Now, that is different from triggering a leadership contest. That is about entering a contest that is already underway. And he says he'd have to persuade members of the Parliamentary Labour Party in order to run, which of course he would. So he's still being careful about his language. I think from his perspective, look, you would be, wouldn't you, if you were in his position, because you absolutely cannot be seen at any stage to be presumptuous. Firstly, not least to the people in the Makerfield constituency, with still the best part of a couple of weeks weeks of persuasion to do. Then lots of Labour MPs to persuade, even if he is successful in the by-election. And many of those MPs he doesn't know particularly well, because so many have come into Parliament in recent years. So picking his language carefully, but there was no doubt a step forward, if you like, in his clarity last night.
So given all of that, Chris, does this turn in any way from a by-election into a mini referendum only involving the people of the Makerfield constituency on whether or not the Prime Minister should face a challenge?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is very much that. And on the couple of visits that I've made, you get a real sense of that. And depending on who you ask, and maybe the same person could share both of these views at the same time, it is either a colossal privilege for people there, or frankly, a pain in the neck when folk like me turn up in suits and ties and start asking them questions the whole time. In terms of how that race is looking, Anna, with, as I say, just under a fortnight of it to run, Labour seem quietly confident. There is a new poll from Survation. We should insert some caveats, because constituency polling is very difficult to do, to get a representative sample in such a small area. But that poll suggests Labour on 49%, Reform on 39%, so a 10-point gap there. Restore Britain, this party set up by a former Reform MP, on 8%. So you combine Reform and Restore, and suddenly the gap to Labour is much, much narrower. There was another poll also by Survation a couple of days back, with the gap between Labour and Reform smaller than this current poll. As I say, insert caveats about polling, but I think it broadly matches some of the sentiment I'm picking up from Labour, but clearly still plenty of time to go.
Yeah, there is. Interesting. Thank you, Chris. We're going to hear more from the constituency on the programme on Monday as well. It is 19 minutes past seven now. Retailers often talk about the impact that good weather can have on actually getting us out of the house and out to the shops. But data this morning from the British Retail Consortium suggests that that was not enough to stop a drop in what they call footfall. Will is back with more on that. Hi, Will.
Morning again, Anna. Yes, the BRC's numbers suggested footfall in May was 2.6% lower than the same time last year, although it was a recovery from what was a dreadful April, where there was a 10.7% year-on-year fall. Nick Stowe, Chief Executive of the High Street fashion brands Monsoon and Accessorize, is with us. Nick, morning.
Good morning.
What are we to make of this then? Because there seem to be sort of glimmers of light in that people were coming back compared to that April, and yet still not enough kind of confidence to get out there and spend at the kind of the levels that we saw a year earlier.
Yeah, I saw the data. I think the BRC aren't very happy about the sunshine, but I think
too much sun, wrong kind of rain, that sort of thing.
Too much sun. Look, we can't have too much sun. The footfall might have been down, but you have to look at the spending. And so for us, for Monsoon and Accessorize, you know, we're fashion brands, we're summer brands, and we had an amazing end of May during that heat wave. And people went out, and I think there's been a lot of probably bottled up desire to spend ahead of the summer. And we saw that come out.
So that's interesting.
In
are you starting to see a bit of confidence then from households again? Because we've heard about sort of a real lack of business confidence in terms of spending, a lack of household spending. Are you starting to see that shift then finally?
I don't know if it's confidence. I think people are a little bit fed up, to be honest, with the news. And, you know, you kick off the summer and people just want to put it behind them and get out and go on holiday. And, you know, for us, we always say it takes 3 days of a heat wave and then the summer kicks off. And that certainly is what we felt in May. So it was a really good month for us. It is hard out there. You know, I think the footfall isn't where everyone would like it to be, depending on what category you're in as a retailer. You know, you're maybe not as happy as us. But so it is hard, but we're certainly seeing signs of life.
And what about travel? As you say, big part of your business, people buying stuff to go on their holidays. We've heard, you know, concerns, people delaying booking those holidays for various reasons. Is that having an impact?
Yeah, we saw that and we're worried about it, but that hasn't proved to be the case. I mean, people are traveling. Our airport business is amazing right now. And we had a great year last year, so we were worried that it wasn't going to comp that and be as good. But it's great. People are still out there. You know, who knows how long that's going to last? But for now, people are certainly traveling. There is spend out there. You know, I think people have savings. They're spending it cautiously, but they are spending. And so, you know, we're fortunate to be in a position where we can pick up some of that spend.
Nick, thanks so much for your time. Nick Stowe, the Chief Executive of Monsoon.
Well, thank you. 21 minutes past seven. One in four babies in England are now delivered by emergency caesarean operations. Not just caesareans, but emergency caesareans. Experts are describing it as a total change in how women give birth. It's not clear exactly what's causing it or, indeed, the impact on maternity safety. Our health correspondent, Catherine Burns, has been on a labour ward.
Testing his already impressive lungs. But baby Hamza's arrival was not in the birth plan. Mum Nusra needed an emergency caesarean. She was one of several women I met over 2 days at the maternity unit at Northwick Park Hospital in northwest London. Our data shows a major change over the last 5 years in how women in England are giving birth. There's been a fall in vaginal deliveries. Planned caesareans have increased, but the biggest change is in emergency caesareans, up from 18 to 26%. So what's going on? A question for Professor Shakila Thangarinathum from the University of Liverpool.
We just don't know why the rates are going up. We need to have good quality data that tells us why caesarean sections are being done, in whom they're being done, and when the caesarean sections are being done as well.
Shakila wants to know what part race has to play in this. The national average might be 1 in 4, but it's more like 1 in 3 for Black and Asian mums. It's also true that mums are getting older and heavier and there are more complicated pregnancies. This all contributes to the increase, but it isn't enough to fully explain it.
The reports out today make for some difficult reading. Criticisms about the state of maternity services.
There have been several high-profile maternity safety scandals in the news recently.
And some families are pressing for a public inquiry.
And there's the threat of litigation too. Maternity claims against the NHS are up by 11% over 5 years. Clinicians across the country have told me that a fear of being sued or getting things so wrong could make an emergency C-section more likely.
And that's when I got told, look, if he can't survive a contraction, he won't probably be able to bear the stress of labour. Then I got told...
New mum Cushy is recovering after surgery.
I was very scared. Like, I was very scared because it was never in my mind to have a C-section.
She had a Category 1 emergency caesarean. That's when there's an immediate risk to the life of the mother or baby. Other categories are much less urgent.
I was nervous because this is an operation. You don't know what could happen.
She's dealing with the pain of recovery, and experts also warn about the mental trauma that comes with unplanned operations. These surgeries can and do save lives. But as the rate of emergency caesareans goes up, you might expect a fall in the worst outcomes. So far, that isn't happening.
Is the system set up to deal with this level of demand?
Short answer is no.
Dr. Alison Wright is president of the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists.
That is a real concern of mine. If we do not invest in our workforce and in our operating theatre capacity, we may be in a position in the future where we cannot do the emergency caesareans we need to.
We're back here for day two. We've been called in on quite short notice because Nusra has started contracting. They didn't want that to happen. So this is an emergency caesarean section now.
So we're anticipating a complex surgery.
Dr. Deepa Srinivasan is the surgeon.
So it's an emergency because the baby is lying transverse, like a boat, and because she's contracting.
She doesn't want us recording until the baby is safely delivered. A tense 20 minutes later, relief. As soon as Hamza takes that first breath, our team is allowed into theatre in time to see his umbilical cord being cut. It's not the birth they planned, but Hamza is in good health. And finally, Nusra gets to meet her baby boy.
Mummy is going to get the first kiss.
In the bustle of the busy theatre, a precious moment of peace.
Hello.
The families we met are so grateful for the care they received. Now they're on to the real business. Life with a newborn.
As Catherine Burns reporting, it's 26 minutes past seven. Time for the sport. Mike's back.
Anna, thank you. Quite the comeback from Ollie Robinson yesterday.
Round the wicket he goes and bowls. It's in on the pad. Beale for leg before wicket. It's out. 3 wickets in the over. Wow, what a start. New Zealand are 2 for 3.
So speechless about how it's gone. Couldn't really have dreamt up that day. There's a whole group. We were right on it from ball one, and it's just such a special day. I have no words, to be honest.
Bowls to Mitchell. Oh, he's bowled him. He's let it go. And Robinson has got another one. And England are rampant here. 20 for 5.
Yes, Seema Olli Robinson, back in the England side for the first time in over 2 years, took 4 wickets yesterday, including 3 in the same over, to help reduce New Zealand to 61 for 6. It makes England's first innings total of 140 look slightly more respectable. Well, we will look ahead to day 2 of the first test at Lord's in the next hour of the programme with the former England captain, Andrew Strauss. Talking football this hour, though, because Liverpool have a new manager. As was widely expected, the club announced that the former Bournemouth boss Andoni Iraola is their new manager. The Spaniard has signed a 2-year deal at Anfield. Well, let's have a quick chat with Mike Hughes from BBC Radio Merseyside, who's across this. Mike, what will an Andoni Iraola Liverpool team look like next season, do we think?
I think it would look very different from what we saw from Liverpool under Arne Slot, certainly last season. Much more aggressive, much more physical, energetic. They play with a real intensity, certainly if we use Bournemouth as a platform from which to inspect the style that Iraola will bring to Liverpool. There's a physicality about the approach, similar in some respects to Liverpool under Jurgen Klopp. There certainly won't be much of an emphasis on back and across. I think we saw that far too often from Liverpool under Arne Slot last season. So it's going to be certainly very, very vigorous and energetic, as I say. And it's going to be really exciting from a Liverpool fans' perspective to see this new style. It is going to take a little bit of time, I think, for the players to get used to this approach. And that will be more difficult, of course, in a World Cup year.
And they've made this move early, haven't they? Are we expecting from that then, Iraola and the club, to have a busy summer transfer-wise?
Yeah, I think Liverpool do need to address certainly different aspects of the squad. He'll need to look at the situation with regard to Alisson. Juventus being linked with a move to him, for him. Curtis Jones and Joe Gomez, they've been linked with moves away. I think Liverpool badly need pace at the top end of the pitch. And Yandy Amande has been linked with a move to Liverpool, Bradley Barcola as well. But they need a defensive midfielder too, as well as Ryan Gravenberg did in Liverpool's title-winning season under Arne Slot. His form dipped badly last season, and Liverpool need to have sort of an extra shield in front of a defence that conceded far too many goals. So it is going to be a really busy summer, and the sooner Liverpool have got the new man installed and he's ready to look at what his approach is going to be to the transfer market, then yeah, Liverpool can hopefully address the situations that need addressing, and there are quite a few of them. And I think it is going to be quite a busy summer in terms of incoming signings and players that may be leaving as well.
A new era begins at Anfield. Mike Hughes from BBC Radio Merseyside, many thanks for that. Just to say elsewhere in football briefly, big night for England's women later. If they can avoid defeat away to the world champion Spain, then they will qualify for next summer's Women's World Cup. You can listen to that match on BBC Sound. Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland also all in qualifying action.
Mike, thank you.
Turning up to a packed fan park at 1 a.m.
Belting out? Yes, sir, I can boogie.
We're dominant!
The group chat's going off for the first time in months.
Now it's Harry Kane! Hammer home!
Football history won't just happen on the pitch.
Kings of football!
It'll happen with all of us.
You can't get this anywhere else.
Be part of every moment from the FIFA World Cup 2026.
Let's make it iconic. Starts Thursday.
Watch on iPlayer.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
On the way, after the news, the head of the armed forces gives a rare interview on the true state of our national defence and the threats that we face.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4 with Anna Foster and Salford, Justin Webb in London. It is 29 minutes to 8. Alan Smith has the news.
The National Audit Office says Andrew Mountbatten Windsor sublet 3 properties on the estate of his former home Royal Lodge in Windsor for an undisclosed sum. An investigation by the Public Spending Watchdog into the property arrangements of members of the royal family also found that the former Prince Andrew's daughters were living in palaces with their rent paid personally by the King. The Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, has said he would try to enter any Labour leadership contest should he win the Makerfield by-election later this month. During a BBC Question Time debate, the Reform candidate, Robert Kenyon, accused Mr Burnham of using the constituency as a stepping stone. Downing Street said no leadership contest had been triggered and the Prime Minister wouldn't walk away. A full list of candidates standing in Makerfield can be found on the BBC News website. The Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch, says conflict over identity politics in the UK could lead to civil war in the long term. Speaking before Vikram Digwa was sentenced to life imprisonment for the murder of Henry Novak, Mrs. Badenoch said hostility from groups on both the left and the right was being directed towards people of every ethnicity. Ukraine's President Zelensky has written an open letter to his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin, inviting him for face-to-face talks on ending the war. Mr. Zelensky writes that Russians have grown tired of Ukrainian drone attacks, inflation and fuel shortages. The Kremlin says Mr. Zelensky is welcome to meet Mr. Putin in Moscow. A cross-party group of MPs says the asylum system is failing to cope with the severe pressure it's under. The Public Accounts Committee says the government is at considerable risk of repeating past failures. The Home Office says the system is being reformed and costs are coming down. And Sir Gareth Southgate says the way boys and girls are taught in schools should be changed to take account of their fundamental differences. The former England football manager says reform is needed to help boys and young men who feel isolated and are struggling with their mental health.
Thank you for that. 27 minutes to 8 is the time. The Chief of the Defence Staff is the professional head of all our armed forces. Sir Richard Knighton is not a political figure. He doesn't involve himself publicly in the debate raging about money. But in an interview with us, he makes it very clear how worried he thinks we should all be about our defence. He's chosen to speak ahead of the D-Day anniversary, but his intervention also comes in the days before the publication, itself long delayed, of the Defence Investment Plan, which is expected to commit huge extra funds to defence spending, but possibly not as much as some military leaders want. Lord Robertson, the Labour peer who chaired the Strategic Defence Review for the government, has accused the Treasury of vandalism and successive governments of allowing our armed forces to be hollowed out. Let us hear what Sir Richard Knighton has to say. We began with his thoughts about the D-Day commemorations coming up at the weekend.
As more and more of the veterans pass away, it's increasingly important that we do remember on their behalf that sacrifice and the courage that they demonstrated, and also the strength of the alliance that allowed us to fight for freedom and push Nazi Germany back and ultimately lead to their surrender.
How close are we now to having to fight again against Russia?
Well, what we have seen over the last few years with the illegal invasion of Ukraine is Russia's willingness to use military force against another nation. I mean, closer to home, we have seen in 2026 more long-range aviation from Russia. These are strategic aircraft that will go well into our own airspace. We've seen as many in 2026 as we saw in 2025. NATO scrambled 700 times in response to Russian activity. And so we're seeing Russia probing, challenging, testing our defences, both traditional military defences, but also, as you heard from the head of GCHQ the other day, whether that's cyber attacks or trying to smuggle technology and reckless sabotage and assassination attempts. So Russia is definitely raising the stakes and risk crossing a line.
And the suggestion is from inside our armed forces, but also from some outside who are very much friends of those armed forces, and I'm thinking of Lord Robertson, about whom we might talk in a second, the suggestion is we're just not ready for it.
Our armed forces and the men and women of our armed forces are always ready, but what we know is that the threat is changing and developing, and as a consequence, we need to respond to it. And Lord Robertson's report alongside his co-authors in the Strategic Defence Review made that clear. And our job in the armed forces is to ready ourselves for that changing threat. And it's partly why the Prime Minister in his Munich Security Conference talked about spending more on defence and doing it faster, as well as committing to spending 3.5% of GDP on defence.
Yes, talked about it, but we haven't seen the money yet, have we? How important is it that we do, and soon?
Well, I think the previous government and this government has committed to spend more on defence and has done that. You've seen.
But again, sorry to interrupt, but again, these are commitments for the future. These are commitments for the future, aren't they? And I think, and the point that Lord Robinson himself made, I mean, he used this phrase, didn't he? A corrosive complacency among political leadership. A military, former military leader said to us, there are flat earthers in the Treasury. In other words, this is not as simple as people setting out a programme and then saying we're going to back it up with money. The suggestion is that they are not willing to do the work necessary to get the money to you.
We have seen increases in defence spending, but you're right, exactly as the Prime Minister says, we need to spend more on defence and do it faster. And the challenge for ministers is to make those difficult trade-off decisions. And that I am confident that the Prime Minister and the ministers around him understand the threats that we face. And I spend a lot of time with the Prime Minister and the Defence Secretary talking about these risks and threats. And so I'm confident that that is understood. But these are difficult decisions for ministers to make.
Well, they are, aren't they? Yes. And I think some possibly in the cabinet, but also some outside, will be saying, you know what, the difference between a few billion extra and a few billion less, if there is better procurement, if there's more efficiency, it won't matter that much. I'm just wondering what you are able to say, and I know this is a political territory and you don't want to get into that, but what you're able to say about how necessary it is that the commitments that have been made and the kinds of money that have been talked about actually do end up being spent.
In my 35-year career, this is the most dangerous period that I have known. And as a consequence, it is important that we enhance the capability and the readiness of our armed forces alongside our allies to deter our adversaries from doing something daft. And that's why it is important that we deliver on enhancements in our efficiency and deliver more capability and put it in the hands of our warfighters. And that is why we have seen increases in defence spending. And I think why successive prime ministers have committed to increase defence spending.
We saw, didn't we? And I take your point that our military people are absolutely fully ready to do what they can. But we saw really recently, didn't we, with HMS Dragon getting stuck in the Mediterranean, we saw at first hand the lack of preparedness that there is. And Lord Robertson has referred to it. He talked in a speech in the House of Lords about just the things that are not ready. He said, we don't have the ammunition, we don't have the training, we don't have the people, the spare parts, the logistics. We don't have the medical capacity, he said, to deal with the mass casualties we'd face if there were to be a high-intensity warfare. In other words, will you at least accept that at the moment, what those who are able to say outside your realm is true, which is that although we would like to be ready, we are not.
Well, the Strategic Defence Review set out very clearly that the armed forces that we have today have been shaped and postured for the world that we faced over the last 25 years. But the world is changing, the circumstances are changing, and what is expected of defence is changing. The demands on defence are rising. We're expected to do more, and we are expected to do different things as a consequence of that changing environment. Our job is to respond to that, and the Strategic Defence Review was the call to arms. And Lord Robertson is right. I spend a lot of time with him, is that that world is changing, and we do need to step up and enhance our capability as the threat from potential adversaries grow.
Is he right that we don't have the ammunition?
So the situation we find ourselves in is one in which over the last two decades, we have been preparing for shorter wars and for conflicts that are confined and limited. What we need to ready ourselves for is potentially much greater, longer conflicts, as we've seen in Ukraine.
Specifically on drones, it's a really interesting point, isn't it? The one you're making about warfare changing. My goodness, it's changed in Ukraine, hasn't it? And people are comparing it, I don't know if you would, to the invention of the machine gun or the tank in terms of the way it changes everything. On drones, are we ready? Are we there?
There's no question in my mind that these drones and autonomous systems are going to become increasingly important in the future of warfare. And we are seeing further investment in those capabilities. But I'm quite clear, as is the head of the Army, Navy and Air Force, that that is an area where we will need to invest more and enhance our capability.
I just come back finally, Sir Richard, to this sense that I think you are wanting to express, that all of us have to wake up, as it were, to a threat that isn't just, we can't just magically wish it away. Is that, am I putting words into your mouth, or is that what you want to express to people this morning?
No, I'm very clear that this is the most dangerous time I have known in my working life. And it is important that society and all of us recognise and understand that, and that that may mean that we need to make different choices and different priorities.
Air Chief Marshal Sir Richard Knighton, Chief of the Defence Staff, thank you very much for talking to us.
It is 18 minutes to 8 in a few minutes. Another really insightful, in-depth interview for you. The former England manager, Sir Gareth Southgate, has been investigating what he sees as a crisis for young men in Britain. So we'll hear from him about that. It's time now, though, for Thought for the Day. And the speaker this morning is the Reverend Dr. Sam Wells, the Vicar of St. Martin in the Fields.
Good morning. Economists, climate scientists and delegates are gathered in Paris to address what's called the polycrisis, climate breakdown, political extremism and rising social tension. They're considering taxes on billionaires, reductions in working hours, a change in diets and transferring investment from industry to education and health. Right now, attention is focusing on tech bros. Some believe a few geniuses will invent our way out of our multiple crises and are entitled to the rewards. Others maintain only a flattening of wealth across our whole society will make life sustainable beyond this generation. It seems like a face-off between liberty and equality. What's seldom recognised is that these are originally theological notions. Liberty says we're fundamentally solitary creatures. Our well-being is for ourselves to determine. Sin is a personal failure. Repentance is a chance for individual renewal. It's an imposition for the state to inhibit that. By contrast, equality says we're fundamentally collective beings. Our situation in life is profoundly shaped by the social, economic, and psychological conditions around us. Sin is about structural and systemic forces beyond our individual ability to withstand. By combining with one another, we find power to address them. The state rightly steps in to assist and protect when we're struggling, and to catalyse and redistribute to make society fairer. There's plenty of support for both positions in the Bible and theology. But another thing that's often overlooked is how these rival perspectives shape the most basic things about early Christianity. Women and slaves flocked to the first century church because there they found dignity and security in the face of the predations of their masters. Early Christians shared material goods and supported the needy. These were significant practices of equality. But the church also called for individual conversion. It never forgot the centrality of personal relationships and discipline. Most tangibly, it created a weekly event in which each person, based on their individual income and material affluence, brought their respective gift to a common table, whereupon a priest described the personal and social transformation made possible by Christ, after which everyone gathered, ate and drank, but crucially, each received the same. Over the centuries, this came to be called the Eucharist or the Mass, and was ritualized into an elaborate ceremony. But originally, it was a vivid social practice that harmonized a focus on the individual in their gifts, as well as their need for repentance, with the collective ideal that all could flourish and none need be left behind. To get through the polycrisis, we're going to need all the wisdom we can get, but sometimes that wisdom lies in the past, not just the future.
And that was Thought for the Day with the Reverend Dr. Sam Wells. It brings us to 7:45.
Now, he's known for leading the England football team through one of their strongest periods in decades. And Sir Gareth Southgate has made no secret of his ambitions to try to transfer some of that mentality to wider society across the UK. Anna Moll has been speaking to him about a new documentary that's coming out on Monday, just ahead of the start of the World Cup. Because, Anna Moll, he really wants to try and make a difference, doesn't he? Especially for young people. And he thinks that his experience and the leadership experience that he's got makes him well placed to do that.
Morning, boss. Yeah, exactly that. It's exactly as you say. Once you've been England football manager, I think you can go in all manner of directions. And Gareth Southgate is clearly a very civic-minded chap. He was invited by the BBC, actually, to give a lecture called the Dimbleby Lecture. And he decided to do it on what he saw as a series of huge kind of generational challenges facing young men. And I think he was very taken by the response to that lecture. He's now doing a lot of work with the King's Trust, trying to create a national movement around mentoring. And he's done this film, as you mentioned, it's out on Monday. It's called Changing the Game for Young Men. It's a terrific watch. And it kind of quite sensitively looks at the challenges facing young men under a series of different kind of arcs or issues or themes, if you like. So the crisis of work from deindustrialization, the huge rise in fatherlessness, and also the challenges for people who aren't particularly academic in terms of modern education. And when he came by the Today studio, I spoke to Gareth at length about all of this stuff. But I started by asking him how he came to be interested in this whole area of a crisis, a complex set of challenges for young men.
Once you start to unpick and research what was going on, I just kept getting flashing lights of issues that boys are facing today. And of course, your immediate thought is, well, hang on a minute, we haven't sorted out what's going on for women and girls. But I think that's been part of the issue, because there's some brilliant work going on creating better opportunities for women. But within all of that, it shouldn't be an either or. And I think in a big way, we've taken our eyes off some of the issues that men face through their lives. And we have to start thinking about how we address those as well as the issues for women and girls.
In this documentary that you've done for the BBC, you're very mindful early on to say that you and other people have been hesitant about entering this arena because you don't want to cast it as a zero-sum game. That if you're talking about what's good for boys, you don't want to be seen to be talking down girls. And you also don't want to talk down, for instance, single-parent families who do extraordinary work. So it's taken sort of a bit of courage and a bit of guts for you to say, actually, you care about this so much that despite those concerns, you do want to enter this arena.
I think we're all mindful of unifying people in this moment in time that we are. But I'm a proud Englishman, proud Brit. If we're to have a better country moving forward, we've got to get the maximum out of our young people. And it feels as though that might require a slightly different approach when we're educating and developing young men compared to educating and developing young women. And I think anybody that's worked with either sex at a younger age knows there are some fundamental differences. There will always be similarities and there will always be exceptions, but I think there are a lot of common traits that boys have and historic sort of expectations that weigh on them. And the world is changing rapidly. So for example, a lot of the jobs, the manual jobs that men used to do, have disappeared in a lot of the regions of our country. So what does the future look like for them?
In broad terms, what did you get to? What is the generational challenge that young men are facing?
It isn't singular, it's complex. And it reminds me a little bit of when I started working with the Football Association, because people would always want a root and branch review and they'd all have a view on how English football needed to operate to improve the performance of the national team. And they'd all think one thing would make the difference, but it was never one thing. With this issue, you can see that there are issues in terms of the changing dynamic of families. There's the education system where boys start school on average behind girls, their vocabulary is lower. More boys are, you know, their results, their exam results are behind girls. They're more likely to be excluded from school. So there's behavioural things behind that. And then, you know, that's leading to issues of being employable.
A lot of people may not be aware of just what an extraordinary transformation the British family has endured in just the last 50 years. So in 1970, if you were a 14-year-old in the UK, the chances that you live with both natural parents was nearly 80%, 4 in 5, about 79%. Today, it's only half. There's been this complete change in the British family. And 2.5 million children in the UK have no father figure at home. That's 1 in 5 of all dependent children. What has that, mindful though we all are about not wanting to stigmatise extraordinary work that in particular perhaps single mothers do, what has that very sharp rise in absent dads, certainly absent from the home, what impact have you seen it have on young boys and men?
if there isn't a male role model at home, that gap used to be perhaps filled by someone else in the family, or a teacher at school, or a youth worker. And where that gap exists now is that there are very few male teachers in schools. So those boys are then not getting that interaction with men at school. That's not actually to do with the quality of teaching. That's to do with having men in their lives that you kind of, how do you learn as a kid? Well, there's what people tell you, but you then role model yourselves on behaviours and interactions that you see your parents have. But that gap that the huge numbers of fatherless families now have is not being filled by youth workers. It's not being filled by male teachers. And so youngsters are turning to internet influencers. They're perhaps turning to the gang down the street. You know, the choices then that are made start to deteriorate. You know, one of the challenges is how do we fill these kids' lives with the right sort of male role models? Because, of course, it's also fair to say there are families with dad around that isn't a good influence.
And if we turn to solutions, one of the big things that you're keen on is expanding the idea and the nature of education. Do you think that the provision for non-academic boys and girls is good enough?
I think a lot of it seems to have disappeared. So
vocational training, apprenticeship, skills.
Absolutely. I mean, one of the likely outcomes of Alan Milburn's report looks to be, and I'm hearing this in government reports as well, a push for more apprenticeships. And I think for some reason that has started to become a dirty word. You know, when I was growing up, I think it was the top 5% of kids went to university. So I'm not going to knock university education, certainly not when I'm sitting with you.
No, but
but it's not the route for everybody.
But it's expanded and very fast, hasn't it? It's gone from 5% to about 50%.
Absolutely. And the reality of that is it's not really for everybody. And we're going to have a generation of kids with degrees who are out of work. And one of the problems for them is when they're looking for work, a lot of employers are looking for work experience, they're looking for that work readiness, as they're called, the rough edges of turning up on time and how you deal with people that so many youngsters learned in hospitality industry or retail industry through Saturday jobs, and a lot of those opportunities seem to have disappeared. So that, alongside more vocational opportunities in schools, woodwork, metalwork, things that used to be apparent. You know, if you're not academically minded as a young boy, and you're always at the bottom of the class, that's not a great feeling.
A couple of final thoughts. One thing, you mentioned there the kind of people yearning for hope and the cultural script. There's a brilliant author called Richard Reeves, wrote a book called Of Boys and Men, where one of his arguments is that a lot of young women feel that through modern feminism, the narrative that they receive is an empowering one. One of, you know, lots of do's, do be this, do that, do live your best life. Whereas a lot of men, according to that CSJ report, often feel they receive a more negative cultural script. A lot of don'ts. Don't try and do this. Don't be that person. Don't do that. How do you want us to change the cultural script?
I think you're right. The language we use, our young boys are an asset. How do we fulfill their potential? How do we get the best out of them? Rather than how do we stop them doing all the things that we've talked about? You know, I've seen how young talent can be developed when you believe in them, when you give them that feeling of confidence, when you allow them to fail. You know, with young people, you've got to give them opportunities. They're going to fall off their bike.
If I may say, you had a couple of high profile failures or things not working out as you'd want.
Yeah, but that's part of life's journey. I think we're quite critical of the younger generation. You know, I hear them called snowflakes, and that's in part because we're not allowing them the opportunities to go and do things and to fail and learn from them and bounce back. So we've got to create a better environment for our young people. And as I said earlier, then they have to also step up. It's a dual thing. It can't be that they sit there and just complain about everything. They get one shot in this world. And I had a great coach in Terry Venables who always said, this is not a rehearsal.
This is it.
So go for it in life and do the best you can.
If you were writing a letter called Dear England, once again, would that be the message of it? How would it be different this time round?
Well, I think some of the things I spoke about then are still a problem. But I definitely think that we need to think about the optimism. And we're still an amazing country with incredible talent. And the reality is, I mean, personally, there's nowhere else I'd rather live in the world. And I'm sure there are people in many, many other countries who'd love to live in our country. So we need to start speaking more positively about what we've got and what we're good at, and less focus on what we're not doing and where we're slipping behind.
Talking about an amazing country with great talent and what we're good at, I would get sacked, Gareth, if I didn't ask you about England's prospects in the World Cup, which I feel is wholly inappropriate. But there is a World Cup which happens to be starting next week. How confident should England fans be about England's prospects?
Well, the great thing is that this group of players have now been through so many of the hurdles towards winning that we hadn't been through 8 years ago. You know, they're in the mix. There's an expectation, and an expectation among themselves, that they should be in the latter stages of these tournaments now. And, you know, it's still tournament football, so it's unbelievably complex. But, you know, we will win a tournament at some point. I'd have loved to have been there for that moment, but I think it was the right moment for me to step away. And now the baton passes on and, you know, I've become an England fan again.
Gareth Southgate, it's terrific to talk to you.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, some real insight in there, wasn't there? If you want to see the documentary, it's called Gareth Southgate, Changing the Game for Young Men. It's on BBC One and on iPlayer on Monday.
Further insight will doubtless come from any question which is presented, as it always is, by Alex Forsyth. She is standing by. Hello, Alex.
Hello, good morning, Justin. Well, tonight we are in a beautiful part of the country, the town of Kirby Lonsdale in Cumbria on the edge of the Yorkshire Dales. And there we will digest all that has happened in Westminster and more widely this week with our panel. We have Josh McAllister, the Minister for Children and Families. Richard Holden is the Shadow Transport Secretary. Wendy Chamberlain is the Liberal Democrats' Chief Whip and the party's Deputy Leader in Scotland. And Cheryl Jacobs is a columnist for the Daily Telegraph. We will be live at 8 p.m. aiming for that insight. Justin, hope you can join us.
Thank you, Alex. Looking forward to that. Now let's check the weather. Here's Stav Danaos. Hi, Stav.
Hi there, Anna and Justin. Thank you very much. Low pressure's been in charge recently, bringing lots of showers. They've been heavy and thundery in places, and winds have been pretty strong. Today, a little bit of a brief respite, I should say. We're in between weather systems with a brief ridge of high pressure crossing the UK, so we should see fewer showers and the winds will be lighter. But it turns downhill tonight into tomorrow. We'll have a deeper area of low pressure sweeping in across southern areas. Today, though, it brings a mixture of sunny spells and still a few showers around, mostly in the north and the west. But like I mentioned, these showers will be less frequent, not as heavy as the last few days. So many places should stay dry, more in the way of sunny spells here and there, with lighter winds. And if you catch the sunshine, it won't feel too bad today. But temperature-wise, generally, we're still on the cool side of average. For early June, 14 to 20 degrees. Now tonight, clear spells first, with any showers fading away, and then we see wet and windy weather sweeping in from the southwest across all but Scotland. Some of the rain will be quite heavy too. So into tomorrow, the first day of the weekend looks unsettled. We'll have a lot of cloud, wind and some heavy rain through the morning period. That will tend to clear to sunshine and showers into the afternoon, and some of these will be heavy and thundery. Scotland stays mostly cloudy, with variable pieces of rain here and there and lighter winds. But across the south of the UK, it's going to be very windy for the time of year, with gales across southwest England. Temperatures again, 15 to 18 or 19 degrees. Sunday looks better for England and Wales. It's quieter, a bit warmer with sunny spells, but more showers in the north and the west.
Stan, thanks for that. You are listening to Today on BBC Radio 4. It's 8 o'clock on Friday the 5th of June. The headlines this morning: it's emerged that Andrew Mountbatten Windsor was subletting cottages on his former estate at Royal Lodge, and that Princesses Beatrice and Eugenie have had their rent paid by the King. The Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, has said he'll challenge Sir Keir Starmer if there's a Labour leadership contest and he wins in Makerfield. And BBC analysis has shown a sharp rise in the number of babies in England delivered by emergency caesarean section.
And coming up in the next hour, amidst the calls for more defence spending, the head of the World Health Organization says we mustn't forget all kinds of threats we face.
Please don't forget the common enemy that we have, a virus that doesn't care about our borders, our politics. We have to be also prepared for that.
Is Gareth Southgate right when he says non-academic opportunities for young people seem to have disappeared? We'll explore that a little more deeply. And how now to revitalise interest in the Baroque period, a new immersive experience is opening very soon. Before that, the BBC News is read by Alan Smith.
The National Audit Office says Andrew Mountbatten Windsor sublet three properties on the estate of his former home Royal Lodge in Windsor for an undisclosed sum. The public spending watchdog carried out a major investigation into the residential property arrangements provided to members of the royal family. It found that the former Prince Andrew's daughters were living in palaces with their rent paid personally by the King. Here's our royal correspondent Sean Coughlan.
The report, the first of its kind for more than 20 years, was prompted by the scandal surrounding Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, and it reveals details of the 12 royal properties used by the former prince and his family. That includes three cottages near to Royal Lodge, belonging to the Crown Estate, which he was allowed to sublet. It's not known for how much, but palace sources say it was only to cover running costs. As the former Prince Andrew had paid £7.5 million up front for Royal Lodge, he only had to pay a peppercorn rent. Andrew's daughters, Princess Beatrice and Eugenie, are shown to pay no rent to live in St James's Palace and Kensington Palace, despite not being working royals. The rent is paid by the King's personal money. Norman Baker, former Home Office Minister and critic of royal finances, says the public are being taken for a ride. But a Buckingham Palace spokesman said the report was in line with the royal household's commitment to transparency.
A former chair of the Commons Public Accounts Committee, the Labour peer Baroness Hodge, told us she welcomed the report but wanted to establish whether Mr Mountbatten Windsor had benefited from the money that she said should have gone to the nation.
The purpose of the Crown Estate, its first duty, is to generate financial returns and value for the people of the UK, for us as the taxpayer. And if the Crown Estate is operating in a way that is not just serving the taxpayer, but also serving the royal family, it's not meeting its basic purpose. And that causes me worry.
Mr Mountbatten Windsor was photographed driving near his home on the Sandringham estate yesterday with what appeared to be a large bruise on his cheek. It isn't clear what caused the mark, but it's understood to be nothing serious. The Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, has said he'll challenge Sir Keir Starmer if he wins the Makerfield by-election, and there's a Labour leadership contest. Five of the candidates vying to represent that seat faced a Question Time audience yesterday evening. Our political correspondent Ian Watson was watching.
Ever since the former MP Josh Simon stood aside to allow Andy Burnham to stand in Makerfield, the Greater Manchester Mayor has been keen to avoid the impression that he's taking its voters for granted. So he tends to use decipherable code about his intentions, such as the need to change Labour. But pressed on Question Time, he said he'd seek to join a leadership contest. Number 10 pointed out that no such contest had been triggered and that Sir Keir Starmer had no intention of walking away from Downing Street. The Reform UK candidate, Robert Kenyon, accused Mr Burnham of using Makerfield as a stepping stone. The Conservative candidate, Michael Winstanley, said he was disgusted and sad that a by-election had been foisted on local people, and the Lib Dems' Jake Austin suggested that Mr Burnham wanted to become Prime Minister by the back door. Mr Kenyon was also challenged on offensive social media posts from his past. He said he'd made mistakes, but had nothing but respect for women. Asked about the murder of Henry Novak, Mr Kenyon said he condemned the violence in Southampton, but claimed there was two-tier policing. The Greens candidate Sarah Wakefield argued that black people were still twice as likely to be arrested than their white counterparts and four times more likely to be stopped by police. Mr Burnham saw the need for a careful debate on whether to allow people to carry knives for religious reasons.
You can find a full list of all 14 candidates for the Makerfield by-election on the BBC News website. The regulator Ofwat has announced that Welsh Water will pay out £44.7 million for serious breaches in its sewage services. It said the company had been instructed to put things right after it had failed to properly operate, maintain and upgrade its wastewater network. BBC analysis of NHS data shows that one in four babies in England are now delivered by emergency caesarean section, an increase of 8% in the last 5 years. C-sections can be life-saving, but the rise hasn't been accompanied by better overall safety outcomes for women and babies. Our health correspondent Catherine Burns reports.
5 years ago, 18% of deliveries in England were by emergency caesarean sections. Now it's 26%. The NHS does not record data on why these unplanned operations are done, so it's impossible to give a definitive answer about what's driving the increase. Experts stress cesareans can and do save lives, but some are concerned their increased use hasn't led to an overall fall in the worst outcomes. The Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynaecologists says the system is struggling to cope with the extra demand. NHS England says its priority is always the safety and well-being of both mothers and babies.
Ukraine's President Zelensky has written to Vladimir Putin, inviting him to a face-to-face meeting with the aim of ending the war between the two countries. He's also shared a copy of it translated into English on his social media platforms. Vitaly Shevchenko reports from Kyiv.
The tone of the letter was defiant, even mocking, drawing attention to Ukraine's recent strikes on Russian territory. President Zelensky even said that after 26 years in power, age is beginning to take its toll on Vladimir Putin. But the letter also provided an invitation to meet face to face and discuss ways of ending the war. It's not a new offer from Ukraine's leader. Unlike before, the Kremlin responded saying, Mr. Zelensky is welcome to meet Mr. Putin in Moscow. Hours after the letter was published, the US House of Representatives voted to provide aid to Ukraine and impose new sanctions on Russia, with a number of Republicans joining Democrats to pass the bill in defiance of Donald Trump. But it still needs to be approved by the Senate, and even then it could be vetoed by Mr. Trump.
The Chief of the Defence Staff, Air Chief Marshal Sir Richard Knighton, has told this programme that Russia risks crossing a line with its incursions into UK airspace. He said he was confident the government was increasing defence spending in line with the threat. But he stressed that politicians would have to make some difficult decisions to meet the challenges.
I'm very clear that this is the most dangerous time I have known in my working life. And the risks and threats to this country are greater than I have known since the Cold War. And it is important that society and all of us recognise and understand that, and that that may mean that we need to make different choices and different priorities.
The Attorney General, Lord Hermer, has accused some critics who want to shake up of human rights laws to tackle small boat crossings of being willing to allow people to drown in the water. Speaking to Nick Robinson on the BBC's Political Thinking podcast, he rejected calls for the UK to withdraw from the European Convention on Human Rights, and he attacked opponents who proposed rounding people up on the beaches and sending them elsewhere.
I think what they mean by that is they let people drown in the water, and that is not a British way to deal with it. That is not commensurate with our values. The way to deal with it is the way that we've been dealing with it, and we're going to carry rolling out further agreements, which is cooperation with the states through which people are travelling, through which people are launching boats, and we do that through our membership of the Council of Europe.
The owner of the William Hill betting shop, Evoke, has agreed to a £243 million takeover by the Greek gambling firm Bally's Intralot. The companies said that an increase in gambling taxes in the UK and heightened competition had led to the opportunity for consolidation. Mangroves, which help fight global warming, are staging a comeback around the world after decades of destruction. These dense coastal forests have been threatened by fish farming and urban development. But a study published in the journal Science says conservation efforts and natural expansion mean that since 2010, the world has gained more mangroves than it's lost. Our environment correspondent Matt McGrath has more.
Mangroves are the unsung heroes of the environment, stemming storms and soaking up carbon in large quantities. But decades of shrimp farming and the expansion of coastal cities has seen them cleared in vast amounts from shorelines, especially in Asia. However, this new study suggests the tide has turned, and once humans stopped chopping them down, these resilient forests have expanded rapidly in many regions. In Indonesia, home to the world's largest mangrove ecosystem, the picture has stabilised in part because of increased public awareness of the positive role mangroves played in slowing the 2004 Indian Ocean tsunami.
That was our environment correspondent, Matt McGrath.
Thank you, Alan. It's 10 minutes past eight now. At the end of a week where racism in society, particularly in the criminal justice system and policing, has been in the spotlight, We're going to speak to the government's most senior legal voice. The murder of Henry Novak and the way that he was treated by officers as he lay dying has led to robust political responses from all sides. But how best to address the challenges and problems that this case has highlighted? Well, David Lammy is the Secretary of State for Justice and Lord Chancellor, as well as being the Deputy Prime Minister. And this is a topic that he has focused on for years, including with the publication of the Lammy Review back in 2017, which examined racial bias in the justice system and concluded that, among other things, racial disparities do exist and need to be tackled. And he joins us. David Lammy, good morning.
Good morning, Anna.
Do you think that policing at the moment, and this has been a question asked so many times this week, do you think policing is in the right place when it comes to racism?
Up and down the country, the police are having to act every moment of the day, and overwhelmingly, I think that they do a tremendous job on behalf of the British people and that they treat people, all people, equal before the law. It is also the case in our country that there have been moments of huge national concern. I'm thinking back to the Stephen Lawrence case, the McPherson inquiry, and all that flowed from that. And again, there is guidance and update and concern about issues like racism or the treatment of women before the law by policing. When I looked at that video of Henry Novak, it was harrowing. I have two boys around the same age. My heart goes out to the family. They're calling for common sense policing. They're calling for us to continue to bear down on knife crime, understandably. There are now several inquiries, the IOPC investigation, the inquest into Henry's death and the circumstances of his death. The National Police Chief are looking at the guidance. And I understand that the Attorney General is also looking as to whether he should make a referral of this case to the Court of Appeal. Mm. That is the democratic system we have. It's the right one. And overwhelmingly, I do think we've got to recognise that policing in this country, of course, there's much to do to improve it, but we want the police to get on and do the job of making sure that those who commit harm, cause crime in our communities, are properly dealt with fairly.
I wanted to ask you specifically about that guidance from the National Police Chiefs Council, because again, as I highlighted in the introduction, a lot of people are coming to this topic for the first time this week. They've got a lot to say, but you've been focusing on this for years. And that particular guidance, so we spoke to the policing minister, Sarah Jones, your colleague, earlier this week, and she said that the guidance is wrong and needs to be looked at, particularly where it talks about equity, racial equity rather than racial equality. But then the head of the National Black Police Association, Andy George, told us a few days later that actually a move to redraft that in light of this case would be reactive. And he is concerned that police forces are at risk of making changes that are not well thought out. So where do you stand on that? Should it be changed? Would that be reactive? Is it doing the right thing as it stands?
I think the balance, Anna, is always to return to the principles, and that is that we are all equal before the law, all of us. There are circumstances in guidance that the police have to take into circumstances as they're making these finely balanced decisions in criminal settings. I think it is good that the National Police Chiefs are looking closely at the language, because the police need clarity, the public need clarity in these circumstances, and it sounds like there's not clarity fully in this area. So it's right that they look at that very carefully, I think.
It sounds like you think that it should be changed from where it stands just now.
I don't think it would be right for me as Secretary of State for Justice when, as I've said, there are a number of live investigations and inquiries in this case to pronounce on what
should
happen.
It's about the guidance rather than this particular case. And I appreciate what you're saying about being Secretary of State for Justice. But as we've said, you're also somebody who has looked at this topic in depth. And the way you answered it, it made it sound like you think that the wording is perhaps not quite right as it stands. And you can make a personal judgment on that.
No, I'm very clear about my constitutional role. But look, let me say this, that go back to the starting point. We're all equal before the law. all of your listeners will recognise, because you've covered it for years and years on the Today programme. Incidents like the murder of Stephen Lawrence, the cover-up after his death, the McPherson inquiry, and all that flowed from that. They will also understand that there may be circumstances where the police do have to consider certain factors. But it's important that guidance is clear and understandable.
And so these things are
always right to be revised.
Yeah, that particular document, does contain the line, and again, this is what's drawn criticism this week. It says, it does not mean treating everyone the same or being colourblind. Is that the sort of thing that because you are saying that everybody should be equal under the law, but the guidance says it doesn't mean treating everyone the same.
Look, let me give you an example where the police, or indeed our judiciary on their guidance, have to have a certain understanding. Saturday, in a constituency like mine, where we have an Orthodox Jewish community, it is Sabbath, and there are particularities in relation to the behaviour of our community as a result of that. Expecting someone to turn up and present themselves at the police station in those circumstances in a religious festival might be unacceptable. So, look, there are particular circumstances in which, of course, the police have to go a bit deeper than treating everybody equally. I think we all understand that.
So just for clarity, you're not concerned that the response and the reaction to this particular case might lead to a rolling back of some of the protections for people from ethnic minorities that you yourself had advocated for?
The criminal justice system has always got to be responsive to the population at large and the expectations of the population at large. Everyone looking at that were just, it was horrendous how Henry was treated in those dying moments, sadly, of his life. And for that reason, and this is now a big, I think, case in the national consciousness of the country, all of us have to look very closely at the guidance, the circumstances in which the police are asked to act.
The US State Department, and you might not have seen this, I realise, the US State Department posted on social media last night, and while sending their condolences to the family of Henry Novak and the people of the United Kingdom, it contains these two sentences. It says, ideological conditioning and two-tiered policing are glaring symptoms of civilizational decline. They must be rejected across the West. There is an implicit message in there that there is two-tier policing in the UK. Again, I asked Sarah Jones about this earlier in the week, and essentially she said she didn't believe that there was an inherent system of two-tier policing, but she thought that there were examples of it that shouldn't be happening. What would you say in response to that message from the US State Department?
Well, I saw the message, and obviously we work very closely with the United States. Our law enforcement, in fact, works very closely with the United States. And I saw that there was a message of condolence to the family, and I thank the United States for that message of condolence. I don't recognise this caricature of a two-tier policing system in our country. I just don't see it in the interactions I have with policing. And so I do reject that.
I wanted to ask you about comments made by the Conservative leader, Kemi Badenoch. Now, this is in a new documentary for the BBC. It's called England's Identity Crisis. It's on this weekend. And it was recorded, it's important to say, before the events of this week. And she's also taking a longer term view. But she makes a very striking point. She told the BBC that conflict over identity politics in the UK could lead to civil war in the long term. Is that a concern that you share?
Well, I look forward to looking at the documentary. Anna, you might recall that I wrote in my book Tribes about identity politics and my concerns at this time. And my emphasis when I was writing, that was over 5 years ago, but I think it still all applies, is how we come back together as a society, how we unite as a society, how we're a society that recognises and tolerates difference, but in the end is able to be collective and come back together. That's why I support Henry's family calling for us to be united, calling for a common sense approach, and not divided. But of course it's the case that if we all peel off into our separate identities, it can lead to a position in which a country is far less than united. I sit here as the Deputy Prime Minister. I'm very proud of my African descent. I'm hugely proud of being English, of being a Black Briton, of being a Christian. I'm holding all of those identities at the same time. But overwhelmingly, my job is to represent this great country. And I'm hugely proud to have the privilege to do that on behalf of all of the British people.
Hmm. Yeah, it's interesting to hear there's a degree of concern that you share there. I wanted to play you something, actually, on a different topic as well. Paul Quinn today will be sentenced. He is the man that was found guilty of the crime that Andrew Malkinson went to prison wrongly for 17 years for. And Justin spoke to Andrew Malkinson again just a few weeks ago when Paul Quinn was convicted. And there was something that he raised and that he wanted to put to you directly. And I'd like to play it to you in his own words, because he raised the issue of, despite the fact that he was not in prison because of anything that he'd done, it was not his fault, he's being asked to deduct legal fees and the cost of experts to actually help him win his freedom from his compensation. This is what he had to say.
They are going to deduct my expenses for the experts, which could be up to $10,000, and the legal fees for my compensation. So I have to pay for my own damage assessment and legal fees.
What's their justification for that?
I don't know what the justification is, Justin, but I think it's I don't know. It doesn't make any sense at all to do that, except to say, obviously, they're trying to claw back as much as possible. They're penny pinching. So I think this is something that David Lammy could fix with the stroke of a pen tomorrow, easily, you know. And I'd like to ask him, does he think this is fair?
Do you think it is fair, David Lammy?
Well, can I say that I'm very keen to meet with Andrew Malkinson and to understand his concerns in great detail. And of course, my heart goes out to him, and I'm sorry that he experienced a justice system which was hugely unjust in relation to his case and his condition. The Law Commission are looking at this issue. We have increased compensation for people in these circumstances. The Law Commission are at the moment looking closely at this situation. We've increased compensation, I think, to 1.3 million. But I'm keen to meet with him and understand what more I may, in fact, need to do.
His specific question, I'd just like to return to that. His specific question to you was, do you think that's fair?
I am open to looking at the detail of his case and looking at those circumstances in which he had to meet his own legal costs. I am open to that.
And I just wanted to ask you one final question about your colleague Andy Burnham, of course, who appeared on Question Time last night. There was a special Question Time for the Makerfield by-election. By the way, if you want to see all the candidates standing, they're on the BBC News website. I'm not going to ask you who you are backing in any potential leadership challenge, which, of course, hasn't been launched yet. Important to say that as well. But I just wondered what you would say to people in that constituency now who we've heard from, who are very much wondering whether or not a vote for Labour at the by-election in 2 weeks' time is implicitly a vote of no confidence in the Prime Minister. What would you say to them?
Oh, no, look, Andy is running in that election. I was up there knocking on doors on his behalf. I'll be up there again. I want people to vote Labour. He's running against a Reform candidate who's made vile sexist statements in the past, and I want him to win. I've known Andy for over 25 years. He'll be a great asset in Westminster and certainly a great asset for that constituency. He said himself, it's really clear, there isn't a contest at the moment. You know, you need 81 MPs to come forward for there to be a contest. The Prime Minister has been absolutely crystal clear. If there is a contest, he'll be in it. The Prime Minister has my full support. He had a mandate from the British people less than 2 years ago. We've got 3 years and a bit to run on that mandate, and we'll just deliver for the British people.
Just for clarity, and it's also worth saying as well that the Reform candidate you were talking about there, he did say, he was asked about those posts, he did say that they were old posts and that his views have changed since then. It's important to reflect Robert Kenyon's views on that. But again, directly to people in that constituency of Makerfield? It is a question that they're asking, and I know you've reiterated that there isn't a leadership challenge, and I made that point as well, but it is something they're wondering. They're saying, if I vote for Andy Burnham, is that me essentially saying I think there should be change at the top of the Labour Party?
I've got to say, when I knocked on doors, that was not what people were raising with me. They were raising the NHS, they were raising neighbourhood policing, they were raising local services. That's what they were raising on the doorstep with me. I think that they recognise, of course, that this is an important election. They have a very, very able candidate in the shape of Andy Burnham, a candidate with huge strengths that, of course, okay. is going to make a big contribution
to Labour. So you're not going to be drawn on that, that's fine. David Lammy, the Deputy Prime Minister, Justice Secretary, thank you for joining us.
26 minutes past eight is the time. The St. Petersburg International Economic Forum is a grand-sounding name for an institution that is under some pressure this year. The Russian answer to Davos, intended to showcase Russian economic might, is taking place amid the smoke of war. Ukrainian drones hit oil storage targets just outside the city the day before it all got underway. Still, President Putin is going to attend. He's going to make his big speech today. And a US delegation is also attending for the first time in nearly a decade. Let us turn to Steve Rosenberg, our Russia editor, who is himself in St. Petersburg. Steve, start by setting the scene, because it's odd, isn't it?
Yeah, I've been to quite a few of these St. Petersburg International Economic Forums, or SPIEF for short, but I've never been to one quite like this. That image that we saw on Wednesday, on the opening day of the forum, of thick black smoke rising over St. Petersburg after the Ukrainian drone attack, that is going to be the lasting image from this year's forum. And people who were coming to the expo centre here on the edge of the city saw the smoke. And it was a reminder to everyone about the war on Ukraine, which is now in its fifth year. And many people have been talking about it and wondering what is going to happen, where Russia is heading, and how is this going to end. We heard from Vladimir Putin yesterday. He was talking to heads of international news agencies, and he sort of projected this image of confidence. He was trying to project strength. He still thinks Russia has the advantage in this war, that Russian troops are advancing in all areas of the front line. Russia has advantages of manpower and willpower. But again, thinking back to Wednesday and that image of the smoke, that kind of jars with what was said yesterday.
I'm fascinated that there are Americans there. Who are they? What's their business? Have you managed to talk to them?
Yeah, I don't know if we can actually talk about an official American delegation. I have tried to speak to some of the American guests here this year, not very successfully, Justin, I have to say. I tried to chase Candace Owens, the right-wing commentator who has voiced conspiracy theories. She's here this year. She wouldn't speak to me. And a U.S. official, a Trump official who is sort of in charge of the White House ballroom extension, the ballroom project. He's here, but he wouldn't speak to me. Stephen Sigal, I bumped into him in the corridor. He's a big fan of Vladimir Putin. He didn't speak to me either. But clearly, the organizers and the Russian authorities want to attract as many international guests as they can, and certainly guests from the West and guests from America, and to show that Russia is not isolated. Mm.
Final thought about this offer from Zelensky to meet Putin anywhere he likes, well, anywhere outside Russia that he likes, and the response from Putin. I mean, is that just formulaic stuff? Anything more than that, do you think?
Yeah, well, we haven't heard the official reaction from Vladimir Putin, but up till now, the Kremlin leader has said, you know, if President Zelensky wants to speak to me, he can get on a plane and come to Moscow any time. Well, that's unlikely, since it was Russia that invaded Ukraine. He's also said in the past that he would be prepared to meet the Ukrainian president somewhere to sign a final peace deal, so not to take part in talks and negotiations, but to sign a final deal. Anyway, I expect that we'll hear some reaction, official reaction, from the president during his speech later on today.
Steve Rosenberg in St. Petersburg. Thank you.
29 minutes past eight. It's time for the sport. Here's Mike.
Hello, Anna. Thank you. Well, what a roller coaster day we saw at Lord's yesterday. 16 wickets fell in all on day one of the first test between England and New Zealand, with seamer Ollie Robinson taking the headlines. Back in the England side for the first time in over 2 years, he took 4 wickets yesterday, including 3 in the same over, to help reduce New Zealand to 61 for 6. That's in response to England's subpar first innings total. of 140. Well, delighted to say we can look ahead to day two now with the former England captain, Sir Andrew Strauss, who joins us live on the programme. Hi, Andrew.
Good morning. How are we?
Yeah, we're okay. What about Ollie Robinson? Talk about fully grasping your second chance, back in the fold and back amongst the wickets in style.
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. I was at Lord's yesterday and sort of halfway through the afternoon session, there was a lot of chuntering going on and a lot of sort of disillusionment. And then the great thing about Test cricket is it can turn so quickly. And Ollie Robinson being very much the catalyst for that with a phenomenal first over and the best possible sort of reintroduction to the England team. So a lot of people will be heading to Lord's today feeling sort of very much buoyed by that. And obviously England looking like they're in the ascendancy. So it should be a good day today.
I think we have to doff our cap to the BBC cricket correspondent, Stefan Schemholtz, who's come up with headline of the week for me. So here's to you, Ollie Robinson. England need you more than you will know, is the front page of the BBC good. Sport headline today. But it does, as we say, New Zealand, 61 for 6 resuming later. That makes England's 140 look faintly respectable, doesn't it? But we did see the same old familiar failings with the bat in England's first innings yesterday, Andrew. This was meant to be the great reset, wasn't it? Well, what did you make of that performance?
Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult to judge it on one innings and one performance. It was very tough batting conditions yesterday morning, you know, flurries of rain now and again, a pitch that had plenty of juice in it as well, and a very good New Zealand bowling attack. So I think we just need to sort of pause and hold judgment to a degree. Obviously, Emilio Gay came in and on his debut in possibly the worst possible conditions. What we did see from England was a much more measured approach, and I think that was very obvious to see. Didn't work for them on this occasion, but you know, the truth is Test cricket does fluctuate and does ebb and flow. The key is when you get on top that you make it count and you don't allow the opposition back into the game, and so that's what the challenge for England today is, like polish off that New Zealand innings and then make hay with the bat and hopefully more helpful conditions for batting today.
You mentioned Emilio Gay there, tricky debut for him yesterday, but I just want to ask you overall about his selection and his inclusion in this England side, because it has been for a while since there's been some criticism of how the county game is treated by England and England selectors, that it's overlooked, but a lot of people encouraged by the call-up of Gay, because it is the county game where you can really earn your stripes as a test batsman.
Yeah, I mean, I that's a sort of nuanced debate, really. I mean, ultimately, the requirements of Test cricket are quite different to the requirements of county cricket. And so the England selectors have always got to look at people that are performing in county cricket and go, that is a great starting point. But have they got the game to demonstrate that at Test level? And I think Emilio Gay's shown that he's got a great hunger for runs. He's obviously had a great summer so far, and he sounds like a pretty determined character. We'll see, you know, truthfully, over the next two or three test matches, and hopefully, obviously, that England give him a really good run. You think about someone like Zach Crawley, who everyone felt that they sort of gave too long to, you know, Emilio deserves a good long go himself.
And I know you're heading down to Lord's later for what will be certainly a special, if poignant, day at the home of cricket, the 8th annual Red for Ruth Day, when everyone attending encouraged to wear something red in support of the Ruth Strauss Foundation, the charity named after your late wife, which helps families who are facing the death of a parent, as well as funding research into non-smoking lung cancer. It'll be another special day.
Yeah, and a great opportunity just for us to say a massive thank you to the cricket community for all the support they've given us. I mean, we simply wouldn't be where we are today without that support, not just at the ground, but, you know, it's amazing how many clubs and schools turn their games red and support us in their own way. And it's obviously the best possible platform to tell everyone about what we do, helping those families that are going through the awful ordeal of coming to terms with an incurable diagnosis and having those really tough conversations with kids about a parent who's not going to be around forever. So, you know, we provide that support. It's a very exciting time for us as the Ruth Strauss Foundation as well, because we're teaming up with Maggie's, which is an amazing charity that has 30 fantastic centres around the country that offer support for people going through cancer. And so it allows us to sort of reach more people and extend our services in a way that we couldn't do ourselves. So it really feels like sort of Ruth Strauss Foundation part two, a sort of bigger, better Ruth Strauss Foundation. And again, like the opportunity to be there at Lourdes, that platform we get to see everyone dressed in red, it's going to be magnificent.
Always a very special day. Enjoy it. And many thanks for joining us on the programme this morning. That is Sir Andrew Strauss, former England captain. If there you are, Anna and Justin, if you're heading down to Lourdes later, if you've not left the house yet, go back to your wardrobe, find something red and enjoy the day's cricket down there.
Mike, thank you. Lauren Laverne now with details of what's coming up at 9.
My castaway this week is the TV presenter and former motorcycle racer Guy Martin, who took part in his first race meeting when he was 19.
The first race didn't last long. I think I got about four corners in, took about four boys down and had a massive crash. Yeah, in that first year, I ended up crashing 14 times in that first year. I'll never forget that. Just kept crashing. But I wasn't scared. Just kept crashing. But I just loved it.
Guy Martin, My Castaway. Do join us to hear his Desert Island Discs this morning at 9.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 with Justin Webb in London and Anna Foster in Salford. And at 24 minutes to 9, Alan Smith has a summary of the news.
The Justice Secretary, David Lammy, has told this programme that the police and the public need clarity on an anti-racism document published by the National Police Chiefs Council. The police watchdog, the IOPC, is reviewing the guidance, which states that anti-racism doesn't mean officers treating everyone the same or being colourblind. The guidance has been called into question after the sentencing of Vikram Digwa, the man who murdered the student Henry Novak. The student was falsely accused by Digwa as racism and handcuffed as he lay dying. A report by the spending watchdog has found that Andrew Mountbatten Windsor sublet three properties on the estate of his former home Royal Lodge in Windsor. It also found that the former Prince Andrew's daughters were living in palaces with their rent paid personally by the King. The Mayor of Greater Manchester, Andy Burnham, has told BBC Question Time he would try to enter any Labour leadership contest should he win the Makerfield by-election. A full list of candidates standing can be found on the BBC News website. And one in four babies in England are now delivered by emergency caesarean section, an increase of 8% in the last 5 years. But the rise hasn't been accompanied by better overall safety outcomes for women and babies.
22 minutes to 9 is the time. We heard a plea an hour ago for more money to be spent on defence. We can hear one now for that money to be diverted to the prevention of disease. I've been talking to the Director General of the WHO, Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus. He's been talking to me after visiting Kinshasa, the capital of the Democratic Republic of Congo, where he was assessing the fight against this latest Ebola outbreak. And we began with that outbreak and what he saw of community trust being established as people tried to prevent more deaths.
I was actually hopeful about the future, but at the same time I had serious concerns. There is a lot of misinformation, as you rightly said. There is even fear in the community, but this is because of misinformation. And that if they could be equipped with the right information, if they could be trained, that they could talk to the community, have engagements with the community, and reverse that. So that's one of the things that gave me hope, because when community leaders are involved, I think they can change the tide. But at the same time, there was a real concern. I was worried about many of the things I observed on the ground. There was active conflict. Even the governor didn't want me to stay overnight there. And not only that, there is displacement. People, move, and it's very difficult to do contact tracing and isolating those who have, some risks or contacts. And then, of course, there is a chronic humanitarian problem because of the conflict. And many people are dependent on food aid.
You mentioned humanitarian aid. There have been cuts, of course, to the aid budgets, both the United States and the United Kingdom and other countries as well. Is that having an impact? In other words, can you say with any degree of certainty that the cuts in aid have made this outbreak worse?
The first thing I would like to say is United States and United Kingdom are helping. The funding cuts in 2025 was a challenge. At the Munich Security Conference, I witnessed that many countries from high-income countries, it's not about just the US and UK, but many high-income countries have been announcing at the Munich Security Conference their increase in defense expenditure from 1% to 3%, from 3% to 5%. And I was so worried. And I approached some of the foreign ministers and I said to them, what's happening? Why this significant increase in defense spending? And they said, oh, we have concerns. You know, there is this geopolitical change which is affecting many of our countries, the geopolitical tension. So we have to protect ourselves and we have to invest in defense. So that's why. Then I told them, please, please don't forget about the invisible enemy. And they said, what do you mean by that? And I said, the invisible enemy like COVID, a virus that could wreak havoc. You know, it killed approximately now around 20 million people, the COVID pandemic. So while investing on your defense, this is actually to kill humans, to kill humans, please don't forget the common enemy that we have. A virus that doesn't care about our borders, our politics, or about whatever excuses that we might have. We have to be also prepared for that. So while preparing for what you think is your threat, you have to also be prepared for a threat which is common to humanity. Imagine, have you ever seen a war in recent memory that killed 20 million people? Why can't we come to our senses?
Do you think this Ebola outbreak might spread worldwide?
I don't think so, because, you know, Ebola is transmitted through contacts. So the global risk is low. WHO has said it many times. The regional risk is high, but the global risk is low because of its nature. It's not airborne.
You sound, from what you are saying, genuinely worried about the attitude the whole world has, not just to Ebola, but more widely, as you've been saying, to other potentially worldwide threats. Is that right, that you believe we have reached a position where we are not taking seriously again the threats that might be around the corner?
Yeah, I'm really worried. It's not about viruses. Yes, of course, my responsibility is viruses, you know, health security. But I am worried about, you know, how we're handling even geopolitics, because there is always a solution, a political solution to our problems, geopolitical problems. But I don't see that. There is lack of leadership globally. And you can see the rise in conflict everywhere. And instead of having a political solution, our leaders are resorting into trying to resolve them through might. And I don't think that kind of attitude is helpful.
We hear elsewhere in the program this morning from the chief of the defense staff in the UK. And I think if he were addressing you directly now, he would say, yes, he is serious about peace, but the only way to guarantee peace at the moment, given the threat from Russia, is a big increase in military spending. In other words, what you are advocating, which is a greater spending on other things, including health, just is not feasible in the world we live in.
I think you can strike a balance. And I think if people are willing to invest in finding a political solution, it can happen. The most courageous choose peace. That's what I believe.
Dr. Tedros, thank you so much for talking to us. And at 9:15, Anna, it's interesting, wasn't it? Number one, how impassioned he is about what he thinks is a real imbalance. And he wasn't directing it particularly at Britain, but a real imbalance in the way the world, on the one hand, looks at military spending, and on the other hand, looks at spending about world health. But also more generally, this kind of sense that he's willing to have the battle.
Yeah, do you know what? It was interesting listening to that. And I listened to it from the perspective of somebody. So I covered the last big Ebola outbreak. I was in Sierra Leone back in 2015. And something that I sort of pulled out from between the lines, what he was saying there, talking about Ebola, it doesn't feel as immediately urgent to people around the world. And this is quite a bald assessment, but it is an accurate one because of the way it spreads. Because now we've lived through a COVID pandemic where something has spread and been airborne and affected us all, and we've all been frightened by it. Whereas Ebola spreads differently. It spreads through bodily fluids. So if you don't touch somebody's bodily fluid, then you won't get it. And he said to you there, he doesn't think it'll spread around the world. He thinks it'll be contained where it is. But just seeing the differences, you know, I remember in Sierra Leone that there was so much evidence of particularly UK funding, medical staff, the clinics that they set up and they stocked. It was really evident at the time. And I think what you see now, from the pictures you see now, it's very different. But also, speaking of pictures, you know, you compare something like that, a pandemic, and the way that we get our news, the way that we see pictures of war, of damaged and destroyed buildings, all of those things. And diseases are quieter. You know, we don't see them in the same way. They haven't got that visceral picture to go with them. And I do wonder if that changes the way that we and the politicians and leaders decide where they spend their money.
Yeah, and he's not a naive man. As he said to me in another part of the interview, he pointed out that he had himself been a foreign minister. He was foreign minister of Ethiopia, wasn't he, for a bit. He knows how the world works, etc., etc. And he knows that just saying, you know, butter not guns, as it were, doesn't it itself get us anywhere. But I think he is worried. I mean, it's interesting that he feels that the things he is concerned about, including prevention of the spread of disease and the next pandemic, as it were, is so low down the agendas now of most Western politicians that it's reached a stage where he needs to speak out.
Yeah. And isn't that strange when you think about how high it was? It was only 5 years ago, 5-6 years ago, wasn't it? We were dealing with the COVID pandemic, and everyday life was so very different. And yet that seems like a strange and bygone world now, doesn't it? At the time, we didn't ever think that we'd be in a position where disease and pandemics and the spread of them wouldn't be absolutely at the forefront of our minds. We thought our lives would change forever, but we slip back into normal habits. And as he said there, it suddenly becomes, even only a few years later, really hard to actually get that message through to people that it is a threat that we continue to face.
There we are. 9:12 is the time.
Now, we also heard earlier in the programme from the former England manager, Gareth Southgate. You can hear Amol's interview with him in full on BBC Sounds if you missed it. And one of the things that they talked about was the lack of vocational training in schools.
One of the likely outcomes of Alan Milburn's report looks to be a push for more apprenticeships. And I think for some reason that has started to become a dirty word. You know, when I was growing up, I think it was the top 5% of kids went to university. So I'm not going to knock university education, certainly not when I'm sitting with you.
No, but
but it's not the route for everybody.
But it's expanded very fast, hasn't it? It's gone from 5% to about 50%.
Absolutely. And the reality of that is it's not really for everybody. And we're going to have a generation of kids with degrees who are out of work. And one of the problems for them is when they're looking for work, a lot of employers are looking for work experience, they're looking for that work readiness, as they're called, the rough edges of turning up on time and how you deal with people that so many youngsters learned in hospitality industry or retail industry through Saturday jobs, and a lot of those opportunities seem to have disappeared. So that, alongside more vocational opportunities in schools, woodwork, metalwork, things that used to be apparent.
Well, let's explore that a little more deeply. First of all, with Jacob Beek, who did a level 3 apprenticeship as a heritage marine engineering technician in Oxfordshire. He's 22 now, working in a historic dry dock. Hi, Jacob.
Hello. You're right.
Well, yeah, well, thanks. I hope you are as well. When you were at school and you were hearing about your options, what you could do in the future, were things like what you're doing now, were they offered to you as options? Did people talk about apprenticeships?
So I think it was definitely, I was made aware of apprenticeships, but and I knew that they were sort of accessible and I knew that they were an option, but in a way I didn't know that they were an option for me. So a lot of what everyone, what felt to be expected was going on to sixth form and going on to university or going away to college. But I think an apprenticeship was definitely the route for me. And I think that it's worked out really, really well for me. So I think I was made aware of them, but they weren't pushed the same way that a degree or sixth form was.
I see what you mean. Yeah, it was something from the sideline. So how did you find out about that in the end?
So I started working in the boatyard as a Saturday job, like you mentioned earlier. And that then sort of evolved over time into, you know, working into broader parts of the boatyard. And then that developed into my apprenticeship.
Oh, I see what you mean. So it came in that way. Well, I'm glad it's going well. And it's really good to talk to you. Thank you, Jacob. That's Jacob Beek. Sammy Wright is with us as well, head of a secondary academy in Sunderland, the author of Examination. He also sat on the government's Social Mobility Commission as well. Hello, Sammy.
Hi there.
It feels like there's a really distinct sort of change, or there has been. I mean, I went to school 5 miles from where you teach about 30 years ago, but you really see the change in what, you know, apprenticeships and BTECs and those sort of things, they were very much part of the mix at the time. And it seems, as Jacob was saying, now that university is the thing that is pushed the most.
I think that's both true, but also it's a little bit more complex than that. You know, the numbers of students going on to apprenticeships are increasing, actually. And certainly in our school, we do promote them quite heavily. But the problem that we've got is our whole system is designed around a model which prioritizes academic learning. So effectively, even though we think of our schools as comprehensive schools, they largely follow the model of a grammar that feeds into sixth form, that feeds into university. And all the standard qualifications that we do prioritize the academic over the vocational. And the thing that's really, really tricky with that is that even when you try and get parity, and there's been a lot of effort to try and promote vocational courses, but a lot of the time, the way that's been done is by making them more academic. So there's an attempt, for example, to, you know, make design technology more like sciences by, you know, making the kind of content more examinable. And there's a constant pressure in schools towards making things fit a certain mold.
I see what you mean. Even when they do promote, and that might not, might not help the young people who might want to go down that route. Are there enough, you know, when you're sort of sending them out into the world, are there enough apprenticeships on offer for them to apply for and get? Are there enough vocational courses out there that are really, as you say, doing that vocational work rather than being perhaps a sort of cloaked another version of academia?
Yeah, I think that's another issue. I think there's something about quality of apprenticeships as well. And I think there's something about who gets access to them. So one of the real issues, real problem that we identified back when I was on the Social Mobility Commission was that even as apprenticeships were increasing, the best ones were going to kids from more advantaged homes. Because actually the process of getting an apprenticeship is quite a tricky one. In many ways, it's much easier to take a course at college or even to get into university than to get a degree level apprenticeship. So actually, what seems like an option that, you know, is culturally coded towards being, you know, for kids from working class backgrounds, actually ends up being a little bit more exclusive and hard to get hold of. And a lot of the apprenticeships the more disadvantaged students end up getting are perhaps the ones that are less well supported with less good routes of progression.
Yeah, I think Sammy Wright, thank you very much indeed for talking to us, head of school at a secondary academy in Sunderland. It feels like a really big topic. I think we'll return to this on the programme at some point. But if you want to watch Gareth Southgate's new programme, it's called Changing the Game for Young Men, and it's on BBC One and on the iPlayer on Monday.
5 to 9, just a word to say this morning on Radio 3, from 9 o'clock onwards. Dr. Sean Williams revitalising tunes from John Foles, from Amy Beach, from Arva Pyatt as well, to help brighten and lighten your day. You can find Radio 3 Unwind on your digital radio. It's right next to Radio 3, or just search Unwind on BBC Sounds. Now, something else to lighten your day. The Classical Pride Festival is an annual non-profit event. It celebrates classical music and pride. This year is a big one, a decadent one, what they call a chance to immerse yourself in the splendour of the court of James I and Louis XIV. Historic royal palaces are helping them put on an experience at the Banqueting House in the city of Westminster. And Professor Kate Williams is on the line, royal historian, author of Regina, which is out this week. And here in the studio, Oliver Zethman, the conductor and curator of the Classical Pride Festival. Morning to you both.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Tell us about the royal side of this, first of all, Kate, because it is going to be, well, I mean, it was, in both of these courts were pretty extraordinary, weren't they? Even by the history of royal families in Europe.
Yes, by the history, these are lavish and ostentatious. Versailles, the wonderful chateau that is just so beautiful, that was actually really founded for balls. Louis XIV, it was a hunting lodge. He used to celebrate outside. It wasn't big enough. So Versailles was actually built initially to house these grand balls. And balls were so lavish that the food, the dancing, the dress, Louis put out edicts that he thought that what women liked to wear was too casual and had to be much more strictly approached. And it's impossible to imagine how lavish these balls would have been. And they were gorgeous and they were glamorous. But at the same time, these are political spaces. Where you stand, how you dress, who you speak to, it crafts your whole life at court. So they're both beautiful occasions, but also it's a dog-eat-dog world in terms of politics and in terms of gaining a foothold in both of these courts, which were all about personal favour.
I suspect, Oliver, you're going to be stressing the first of those things rather than the second.
Indeed, yes. Also, really, the point of Classical Pride is to celebrate the huge contribution that, you know, LGBT+ composers have made to classical music. You know, so many of the greatest composers ever, Tchaikovsky, Britten, Barber, Handel, you know, were gay. And so this year at Classical Pride, we're putting on this Baroque Ball. And the premise is that, you know, lots of the most important Baroque composers, Handel, Lully, Corelli, were gay. But actually their music, a lot of it wasn't really written for concert halls. It was party music, you know, particularly Lully, who is the court composer for Louis XIV. All these ballets he wrote, it wasn't you'd sit in a theatre and watch them, the court would dance. Louis himself would come out dressed as Apollo and all this kind of stuff.
So are people going to dance on you?
Yes, exactly.
What's actually going to happen?
So now that, you know, the idea is nowadays you can have a gay night that's pop or techno or whatever. The idea is you can have one that's Baroque music it was written to party to. So it's going to be at Banqueting House, which was built by James I to be his party palace. And we have a whole troupe of dancers choreographed by James Cousins, who did the recent Guys and Dolls at the Bridge Theatre. Daniel Evans, who's the artist director of the Royal Shakespeare Company, is directing it. There's some fantastic singers and actors like Anthony Roth Costanzo, Joe Locke, Dylan Mulvaney, Nikki Spence, Brinda Saar. And the audience are very much encouraged to come in costume. And right. You will be taking part, dancing, amazing, amazing music, that kind of thing.
Of course, Kate Williams, James I was gay as well, wasn't he?
James I had a lot of favourites. He was married, but he also had male favourites. And I think, really, they were the men he could trust, the men he felt he could really sort of talk to in the isolated world of king, considering how his mother had been executed, Mary, Queen of Scots. And these courts are, just as we were saying there, they are about this great artistic flowering, this great artistic endeavour. And at the same time, there's this wonderful music, this wonderful dancing, this glory of the art. So there is it's such a fascinating dichotomy. On one point, people are somehow terrified of going to the ball, but also there's this revelation of beauty and artistic endeavour, particularly in music, particularly in dance. And to see one reincarnated now is really fantastic.
Just a thought, I don't want to be too po-faced, Oliver, but a thought about the decadence in these straitened times and also the potential abuse. I mean, you think of the court of James I. I mean, is it quite the right tone to be setting?
Sure, I think, you know, in difficult times, everyone needs a party. So, you know, come and enjoy yourself. Certainly, Kate was saying, people are scared to go to this ball. You shouldn't be scared to come to this ball.
Right, and where you stand won't necessarily...
No, not at all.
...against you or not. Are you already planning next?